It's an informational.
No, I was just trying.
And I saw.
I thought we had a new member.
Well, she. We have her two. Right.
Well, maybe
they're not here yet.
Early on.
We have two new members.
Okay. And you have Bates and.
Oh, that's right, Congress.
I'd like to call the Senate Interim Committee on Health Care, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy to order. It's Wednesday, November 16th, just a few days before Thanksgiving.
And I will follow by calling the House Interim Committee on Health Care to order on today, and welcome our Senate compatriots to solve all the problems today.
Absolutely. Well, today's an informational hearing, and we will start out by calling up Eric Parsons, Lillian Shirley, Mike Bonetto, and Bruce Goldberg to talk to us about House Bill 3650, Oregon's Health System Transformation.
Yeah.
And before we start, the House wants to do something.
I'd just like to take a moment to allow our newest member to introduce herself. And
he's getting ready to sit down.
Alyssa, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi. Thank you. I'm happy to be here. I'm Alyssa Kenny Geyer, and I'm representing House District 46, which is parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland, and I was appointed to fill the spot of Ben Cannon, who, as you know, is the education advisor to the governor. I'm really happy to be here.
And we have a new member of the committee, although not a new member of the legislature, so perhaps.
Jason Conger, I represent House District 54, which consists of the city of Bend.
And we're just same old people over here.
Well, we also have a visitor,
the
co-chair of the Human Services Subcommittee of the Ways and Means Committee. You want to say hi as well?
Hello, I'm Tim. I'm the co-chair of the Human Services Subcommittee.
District 3A of the Senate is where he's from.
Yeah. Proceed.
Okay, good morning, co-chairs and members of the committee. I'm Eric Parsons, chair of the Oregon Health Policy Board. I'm from Portland, and with me is Lillian Shirley, our co-chair, also from Portland, and Bruce Goldberg, Mike Bonetto. We're some of the same old people you've seen at previous hearings as well. But we're glad to be here, and our purpose today is simply to provide an update on the work of the Health Policy Board in trying to implement House Bill 3650 and give you an opportunity to comment and ask some questions along the way as we go. I'm going to start. We've got some slides on the screen, and I thought I would start with just a couple of very quick reminders in terms of what we're expecting to accomplish. We'll be back to you in February with several deliverables, including draft language for the implementation of our coordinated care organizations, some CCO criteria, process for CCO development, some ideas about medical liability cost containment strategies, and also standards for specified healthcare workers. And so that is consistent with the information that you've received. And on our next next slide, as you well know, all of our work is proceeding in accordance with the plan that was outlined in House Bill 3650. And I won't go through all of these points, but basically you asked us to address a large number of issues with regard to health care delivery in Oregon, and we are well on our way to doing so and looking forward to providing you with our results. One of the things that I thought I would mention early in the presentation is that this has been a process by which we have attempted to solicit and take into account a significant amount of public input. We've had community meetings throughout the state in September and October, hitting a number of communities in the state. We had over 1,000 Oregonians in attendance, and they do have opinions, and we have heard them, as you might well guess. We've conducted an online survey. We've had public testimony at each of our Oregon Health Policy Board meetings, which includes a wide range of healthcare providers and consumers and others who are interested. And also, we have invited specific testimony from a number of organizations that we know have an interest in our work. You might just take a quick look at that last paragraph on the slide, but you can see that it's a good cross section of the folks that have valuable input for all of us. Something we've tried really hard to do diligently. Another important part of the input process has been our work groups. As you probably recall, we had 4 work groups that were appointed by the governor, focusing on CCO criteria, global budgeting, outcomes and metrics, and the Medicare-Medicaid integration piece. We've had 133 individuals representing a real broad diversity of interests working on these groups. They are volunteers. They are finishing up their work this week. Each of them has been reporting monthly to the Health Policy Board. We've been providing feedback to them, and a good back-and-forth conversation has developed. A good share of our presentation today is going to be a quick rundown of some of the input that we've received from these groups, and we're going to ask actually for some of your input as well, if that's okay. Moving quickly to the next slide, because I know that there's a lot to talk about and our time will be limited. One of the work groups, as I mentioned, is focused on the CCO criteria, and a good amount of work, as you might guess, has gone into trying to figure out how do we determine what is an effective, efficient, well-organized, well-governed CCO. Our group has elected to focus on a number of different areas within that broad topic, specifically in-depth conversations about how CCOs do financial reporting, how they govern themselves, how we achieve health equity, and certainly how we make sure that patient rights and responsibilities are respected and protected. And so a good share of the conversation has focused in those areas. On our following slide, it's entitled, Where Are We Now with Regard to the CCO Criteria? As you know, the statute that we are working under requires that the CCO governing boards consist of persons sharing in financial risk and that it also include representation from the community at large. We're trying to take both of those into account. We're trying to understand who all really has financial risk, and we're trying to do that with some diligence. We have tried to figure out exactly what the relationship should be between the board, the advisory board, and so on. Clearly, a lot of people have important input into the governance of CCOs, and so we're working hard to define what the governance structure should be. The discussion after several back and forths between the work group and the Health Policy Board has essentially focused on I would say something that's probably less in the direction of specificity with regard to governance formality, more along the lines of flexibility. Clearly, we have some statutory requirements that we have to deal with. We have to make sure that we have a very clear, strong, well-worded mission, and we need a governance structure that will address those properly. But one of the things that we need to do is make sure that CCOs have the flexibility to deal with the problems that are specific to the regions that they serve. And so from our standpoint, a little more flexibility, a little less specificity in the governance structure is probably of value. I say that with some confidence, but it's actually a topic about which we'd be more than happy to receive some input from this committee. We've asked the same question of many others, and if there are thoughts on this topic, we'd be more than happy to receive them.
We're sort of
quiet right now.
That's all right. It's early in the morning. There are times when we're pretty quiet about these, too, I can assure you.
Yes. I didn't want to interrupt your train of thought.
No, it's quite all right. I'm hoping for some back and forth.
Yeah, okay. You may get it. Oregon Health Authority should reserve the right to evaluate the board as one of the factors of the CCO is not achieving the vision. I'm not sure what not achieving the vision means, mm-hmm. or the right to, what's the group thinking about what to evaluate the board? You know, the right to pull the board? How's the board set up? Is the governor going to set those boards up? Is it going to be done by the community? And, you know, having criteria you have to reach is one thing. Not reaching whatever a vision is pretty loose. This is something that's supposed to be community-driven, not driven by the Oregon Health Authority, and I just want a little clarity on that. So.
Right. Great question, actually. And a fair bit of conversation has gone on in along those lines. I would say that I'll start with the word vision. I mean, it is intended that there be some very specific criteria about how a CCO should be set up and should work and what it is tasked to accomplish. And so I would say achieving all of its organizational goals would be maybe a better way of to look at it than simply achieving a vision. The real question that I think is included here is, in the event that doesn't happen, what are the consequences or what are the reactions? This is maybe a good place to draw a distinction between a little more flexibility and a little less and a little more specificity. One way to go would be to say that if the CCO is simply not meeting its objectives, somebody could fire the board and start all over again. Another way to go would be to say, you know, we're starting on something that is we all think has great potential and great promise, but there's a little bit of risk involved, and maybe we should recognize that we want some of the different CCOs to try some different approaches. Some are going to work really well, some maybe not so much. If you get to a not so much situation, maybe the better thing to do is to apply some technical assistance and some additional help to get everybody onto what turns out to be the most productive track, recognizing we're going to learn some about that along the way.
Representative Kennemer.
Thank you. As you're proceeding, you have kind of an estimate of how many CCOs you see evolving throughout the state?
You know, I don't. I mean, one of the things that we talked about very early is that a number that should be defined at the beginning? Where does the definition come along? I think the right answer probably is we give opportunities to folks to form the CCOs in different regions. Some regions may have one. Some regions may have more than one. Some may overlap a little bit. I think if we get the rest of the criteria right, that's probably all okay. It may also evolve a little over time. We may start with several, end up with some mergers, or maybe even some splits.
In line with that, well, we know we have some areas of the state that are ready to go right away. We have other areas of the state that aren't even close. Is there a procedure, timeline, whatever, for bringing all areas of the state under a CCO? Have you given thought to that? And I'm thinking in terms of, we don't want this to go on for 3 or 5 years or something and build a big disparity in healthcare between areas that have well-developed CCOs and ones that have nothing at all. In the event of that,
right?
You know, how do we get to total coverage?
Another really great question. I would say that it's a question we're really quite aware of. We certainly recognize that the calendar is ticking by relatively quickly. That's not one that we have the final answer on yet, but it's one that's on the list to be included with a final recommendation when we come back to you.
Okay.
Senator Shields?
Thank you, Chair Martin Sanderson. My question, I think, is for Lillian. Lillian, I'm very concerned, and I think most of the panel is, about how this plays out in Multnomah County, where you have several competitors in the Medicaid world, several hospitals practically right next door to each other, and how all this is going to play out. And I'd say I'm more than concerned. I'm panicked about how this is going to play out for very, very needy patients and their ability. We have huge access problems to care in Multnomah County right now. And can you just kind of help me understand where you see things going potentially in Multnomah County and how all the players might end up acting in the best interests of their patients?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball, so let me just say that's a it's a disclaimer. But what I do
for the record, just introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry, Lillian Shirley, Multnomah County Health Department, and Vice Chair of the Oregon Health Policy Board. Senator, thank you. Chair Mona Anderson. Senator Shields, like I said, I don't have a crystal ball, but I do think that while the work of the Health Policy Board is going on to implement the bill and the deliverables in there, there's a lot of conversations taking place. And as in my day job had, you know, have had the opportunity to participate in a number of them. And the hospitals and the safety net providers and the counties also, which provides a tremendous amount of safety net services across the region, have been in dialogues and in conversations in a number of venues, some of them more formal than others. I would say that I'm optimistic at this point that we will be able to come to some resolution before the deadline around the CCOs. And some of the reasons that I feel this way is we've learned a lot in our region about what each other does, just concretely. What is the contribution of the safety nets? What is the contribution of the counties to providing the kind of the baseline of health that the hospitals kind of are downstream and they don't see it, you know, until all else fails, if you will, and somebody needs hospitalization. So I think that those dialogues and that real understanding of each other's businesses in some ways, and what are the levels of risk that each are taking along the way, are really very promising to solve these problems. And, you know, I've been in my job now for 12 years, and I've never seen the hospital system sit down and really be honestly trying to achieve the goals together, and just the whole conversation and dialogue around, oh, well, you know what, we know where the safety net is and we know where the safety net organizations are, but, you know, we really haven't ever, you know, brought them into the table. And just last week or 2 weeks ago, I guess, they've corrected for that in some of these dialogues, that we need more input from the people who are actually taking care of this population before we even see them. And then they're hearing stories about what are the real issues around, say, specialty services. Like, I call them like the people in the middle, you know, between the hospitals and the primary care and the community outreach. You know, really talking and understanding each other's businesses and what are some of the issues that we need to resolve to come to a real. I see the CCO as kind of the holding vessel for the health of the whole community in our region. So I am optimistic, Senator Shields. I really am. And I'd be happy to invite you to some of those meetings, that those conversations and dialogues that are going on. Oh, and one more thing. Two Fridays from now, in fact, the county chairs and vice chairs of the three counties in the metro regions are also going to get together to talk about, you know, how do they see participation. So it's like all of these kind of small steps leading up to the final.
Okay. Can I follow up? So tell me a little bit more, if I could, about those conversations. I mean, what are the big players saying? How do they envision these organizations working together?
Well, I think the conversation that the way I think people are articulating, you know, as this journey has been going on, particularly through the summer and into the fall, is understanding that it really has to be a provider-driven system. It has to be, you know, the providers have to really have some say in how the system is put together in terms of referrals and access. And I think that that's really, you know, that's a really important, not providers as opposed to patient-centered. We still want patient-centered care, but how you get to patient-centered care really has to, you know, really have a larger voice for the people who are actually taking care. What do they need to take care of these patients, for instance? And that voice hasn't been really kind of loud, you know, in the system that we currently have.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you. It's almost, you're going back and forth here to a degree. You're talking about being less prescriptive, which is important, but then you're also talking about meeting the criteria, and which means that we're going to be less prescriptive as long as you're really prescriptive. And, I mean, that's... May not be. I guess my question at this point is, when are we going to be able to see the criteria that you're working on? Keeping fully well in mind that Thanksgiving is next week, which means that February is the week after that. So, you know, our ability to get our... you know, the concept of different communities coming up with their own structure, we've all agreed that that's a very positive thing. But if we are going to be really prescriptive in benchmarks, that may not work. And so I'm hoping that we will be able to, long before February, see some specificity in this area.
Yeah, we'll get to a timeline here at the end of the presentation, but I would tell you that a couple of clarifications. You're right. We've probably confused the issue a little bit with regard to prescriptive and flexible. I would say that ultimately what we hope to accomplish is a system in which we are quite clear about the outcomes we expect and willing to allow for some variability in the way those outcomes are delivered, but then carefully measure whether in fact they are delivered and have some sort of a feedback loop. So that's one way that that we make the distinction there. In terms of timeline, we've got a next Health Policy Board meeting on December 13th, I think. A couple of iterations with regard to a business plan and a final adoption in January for a February delivery. And I would repeat Lillian's thought here. Any of you are welcome to attend the Health Policy Board meetings and some of the others as well. We would love to have input from all of you. And you'll start to see how those criteria are developing.
Representative Kennemer.
Thank you. I guess I wanted to go back to this notion of evaluation, and I just wonder if it might be more productive to move it to a discussion about accountability. It seems that we've been moving in the direction of accountability. Let's get better outcomes. Let's assure that there are better outcomes. At the moment, we seem to think that maybe CCOs is a more functional way to go about delivering services. So the issue is not evaluating whether they meet the criteria. The issue is whether or not they're really performing and saving us some money and delivering better service.
We agree.
Thank you.
We agree. In your packet, there is a document, and it's essentially a matrix of suggested CCO criteria. And you'll see that it starts with a column on the left, which is basically the input we receive from HB 3650, and then moves across in terms of some initial baseline expectations, some transformational expectations, and some examples of accountability assessments, which gets right, I think, to your point. And so you'll see that this is a working draft. It's early. It's going to change, I'm sure. But it'll give you an idea of the kinds of things that we're thinking about.
Senator Bates.
Well, thank you. I'm going to address this to Dr. Goldberg. I'm going to turn to what Senator Shields has brought up. I've had a chance to talk to and travel around the state and talk to rural areas. Portland area would consider rural areas. I don't necessarily concern them myself with that state. But the sense I get is when I go to the coast or Roseburg or Medford or Bend, even up to Eugene, and those areas are moving forward fairly quickly and reasonably with the CCO concept. It looks a little different in each place, but it's coming together. Primarily seems to be driven by the managed care organizations, but in some areas it's not. Samaritan system being a good example of an exception to that. But I agree with Senator Shields. I'm most concerned as far as CCOs being formed with what I call the Tri-County area, Clascanaia, Multnomah, and in Washington counties. Huge healthcare systems there. A large percentage of the primary care base are working inside those systems, not independently. The question I'm getting to is, we need some kind of an honest broker in this area to bring these people together. And the first thing I think of, I haven't heard here, is the managed care organizations in those areas potentially being that honest broker. They reach across a lot of these different fields. Has there been a discussion with them and the FQHCs and the large healthcare systems about some way of using family care or care organ or a combination of those two to really have a way of bringing a CCO or more than one CCO into that Tri-County area? What kind of a discussion is going on? Because I think that's the key discussion.
For the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority.
we began about 6-8 months ago. I brought together all of the current managed care organizations in Portland under our umbrella so we could begin to have the kinds of honest discussions about how to better organize and deliver care in the metropolitan area. As a result of those discussions, we really looked at the five currently operating Medicaid managed care organizations in the Portland area, looked at what in essence is about the 230,000 people that collectively we're responsible for, and began to look at how in the metropolitan area the variety of both managed care as well as delivery systems could now start to work together. That evolved to now a group has gotten together that's included under the auspices of the Health Leadership Council, that's included the managed care organizations and the delivery systems. And this is exactly the conversation that they're having. And I would say it's early, it's nothing's been decided, but they're looking at how to do this. I don't want to predispose how that's going to end up, but it's clear there needs to be some organizing framework, and it's clear that it has to involve both the major pieces of the delivery system as well as a lot of the infrastructure that could help organize the care, which has been the managed care organization. So those conversations are beginning, and I think it's all those folks are really to be applauded, and it's we need to keep letting them do their work, and I think push them for what is the same vision of how this as a community can organize themselves much like many of the other communities have around the state. There's a bit more competition in the Portland area.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I shared Dr. Bates' concern about how the metro area is going to be able to deal with all the competing interests, and agree that through rural Oregon, because there's not a lot of competing interests, it may be easier to form CCOs. And just in general, I kind of wonder how anything ever gets done in Portland, but that's a whole other subject. Last week, I was allowed to come speak to a group up there. I was part of a panel. There was 225 people in the room. And at the end of our panel, Dr. Goldberg and I were part of the panel, a question was asked of this group of providers and really the players in that community, how many people think they can form coordinated care organizations and do what's called for in this bill. And the vast majority of them applauded that they could. I was very impressed and encouraged by the response that I received. And with your comments today, I'm more encouraged that this will work in Portland. Maybe an extra step or two along the way are a little more difficulty than the rest of the state, but I think at the end of the day, people are recognizing there is a better way to coordinate the delivery of health care, and this is a model that we should try.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Madam Senator. First of all, I want to thank you, Mr. Parsons, and Ms. Shirley, for your work on this. I know it's an extraordinary effort, and your service is very much appreciated. The bill specifically talks about the Oregon Health Plan population, and we over and over talk about the Oregon Health Plan population, but the room is full here because it is clear the sense is this may be a way for the future. This may be a way for OEB and PEB and a variety of other things. Do you have that in your mind as you're thinking about this, both dealing specifically with the health plan population and its kickoff, but making sure you have the hooks or the basis or whatever it needs to be so that if it is successful, we can quickly make this model available in a much broader context?
Representative
Another great question. I would say the answer is absolutely yes. The Health Policy Board started its work a couple of years ago following the work of the Health Fund Board, and really the idea was how do we transform the delivery of care throughout Oregon in a way that will provide better outcomes and better cost and so on. We have most recently been focused on the implementation of House Bill 3650 because that's the job that's right in front of us, and that's also the population that that the state is most closely connected with, and so a logical place to start. I think that the members of the board, though, are have not forgotten that the original idea was that we create a system that would be attractive to all of the population of Oregon. And I guess my great hope would be that that we create something that works, that is well received, and that members of other entities, whether it's public employees or commercially insured employees or members of the exchange, would all want to be a part of something very similar.
Thanks, Paul. It's very clear to me and maybe to others, although I've learned to live with the problem that things that are absolutely clear to me aren't necessarily clear to anybody else. is that until we get Medicare under control, and until we get the hospitals into a global budget model where there's only so much money in the state, we're not going to get the healthcare system costs under control. So, to what extent are we creating a model that can work for Medicare? And I know we're doing the dual eligibles, but to what extent can this be viewed as a road for bringing all the Medicare dollars into a single place in the state?
Bruce, you may have some thoughts, or Lillian, or Mike. My thought, and actually that's a bit of a segue into some of the rest of the presentation, and keeping in mind our time, maybe we should start to move in that direction, but I would say that certainly talking about the dual eligibles and figuring out how they become involved is a great first step. If the model can work in this setting, we certainly then have something to take to other settings and propose it. And Bruce, do you want to add anything further in terms of your conversations?
The only comment I think I would make is much about sort of the dichotomous piece that Senator Cruz brought up in terms of being real. How do you both be real specific and at the same time extremely flexible? I think around this, before we get out, we're talking about other populations before we even have a single CCO, and before we actually show that this can work. I think that the framework we've been working under is let's get this up and going. We're optimistic. It's a great model. And if it truly is, and if it does begin to work and deliver the kinds of results we want, which is better care at an affordable price, then it's going to be the appropriate time to have the discussions about the other populations. And in fact, it will be a much easier conversation at that point.
If we build it, and if it works, then maybe they will come.
Yeah, unless it's designed specifically for the Medicaid population. I think that's the point.
That's right. Moving on, if it's okay, to the next slide, there are a couple other things within the CCO criteria, and then I want to turn it over to Lillian for some additional comments. With regard to financial solvency, a couple of things going on. I think there's a general consensus in our group that we really need to be paying attention to the very kinds of things that are leading indicators of ongoing financial solvency, risk reserves, and level and types of reinsurance, and so on. Group has generally agreed with the legislature in recognizing that the CCOs need to be reporting their results to a single state agency. We've given some thought to who that maybe ought to be. Probably our thinking at this point is that the Department of Consumer and Business Services is identified as a very reasonable platform for, in particular, aligning the Medicare and Medicaid requirements. And if, in fact, the those who are serving that population are reporting to DCBS, and if we want them all reporting to the same place, maybe everybody should be reporting there. Again, open for some input if you've got some, but that's just wanted to report that.
Representative Freeman.
Thank you. I like the factors you have. Was there any discussion around the idea of looking at past history? I mean, it seems like we have a lot of organizations in the state that have done this type of thing successfully. It seems like there should be some credence given to those that have demonstrated the ability to do it in the current system.
No question. When we go out with our request for proposals, experience and background and ability to deliver will clearly be a part of the criteria. Absolutely. Good question. The other thing that
Representative Conger.
Thanks. Just a quick question. Have you thought about what happens if a CCO becomes insolvent?
I would say that we have thought about we recognize that we need to have a plan in place if a CCO becomes insolvent. I'm probably a little early today to try to talk about what that would be, but yeah, it's got to be addressed. Okay.
All right.
Okay. Moving one more thing on criteria, and that's simply the recognition that health equity has been a significant topic of conversation. The input we've received from the public is centered very much around the health equity ideas. We are convinced that there are many, many areas in which equity needs to be addressed, not just the obvious ones. And I would say that essentially what we are thinking at this point is that as part of the application process, any potential CCO would be required to perform some kind of a data-driven assessment of community needs, and then tell us how they intend to approach the elimination of health disparities, and so something that we're clearly focused on. With that, if it's okay, I'd like to turn it over to Lillian. Okay.
Thank you, Lillian Shirley, once again. Where we are now with the global budget methodology, and I think that some of the questions that came up in the committee span a number of the work groups. So if we're repeating stuff, you know, we apologize, but also another opportunity for us to, you know, share with you where we are. So on the global budget methodology, we've also brought in some technical assistance from the Centers for Healthcare Strategies to review what other state approaches have been happening and where the trade-offs are. So, you know, none of these things are like fully baked cakes, so we're learning. Some states have gone in one direction, some states have emphasized or prioritized certain aspects of what we're trying to do first, and that we gave the group also, you know, some input so that they can understand, like, how do we land this here for Oregon with our priorities. And there was a general agreement that this is really, that we have to be aware that this is an amazing system change, and we have to emphasize that there has to be a developmental element to however we roll out the CCOs. One of the biggest questions is the risk-sharing trade-offs, and the group has spent a lot of time on this. And again, back to the conversation we had, is it less flexibility in the global budget means really more predictability for the state, but it also means more risk for the CCOs. And if we have more global budget flexibility for the CCOs, it means that there's more risk for the state. So I'm just going to ask for your thoughts on that, because it gets back to that, you know, that hydraulic between the ambiguity between the tension in terms of how we go forward. So we're open to hear where you want us to explore and what your thoughts are on this.
So. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you. You know that risk adjustment has to be a part of it here. I wonder how ready we are to do risk adjustment in a way that really makes some sense. It's a complicated matter, but it seems to me if we don't get risk adjustment right, we've really lost the battle. Do you have a work group working on that? Or
not sure.
Where are you?
Do you want to? Okay. Let's
There's a lot going on.
There's a lot going on. We don't prioritize.
We spent an entire meeting, Chair Greenlee, members of the committee. We spent a lot of time with the work group talking about the variety of risk adjustment methodologies that are available. We looked at all the ones that are currently being used nationally. And in essence, what the work group came up with as a recommendation were several. One, an agreement with what you said, risk adjustment is important. Two, a recognition that we've been doing risk adjustment in the state in Medicaid managed care for 10 years, that we've been using an excellent national model that works well in Medicaid, and that initially we should continue that because it is not broken, so let's not seek to change right away. But I think the third piece was a recognition that as we fold in different populations like Medicare, and that many of the risk adjustment methodologies that currently exist today are imperfect, that we would look to move towards something in the future. But at the time being, it made sense to stay with what we had. But that there are a lot of things that current risk adjustment methodologies don't do, like look at social factors as opposed to medical risks. But there's not a lot of methodologies today that capture that. And so the thought was, this is something that should evolve, but let's stay with what we have at the time being.
Well, there are ones that include function, for example, that I think we've not used right in this, and they are out there.
Right.
I think we need to be more sensitive.
Right. And can I just I think that gets back to the recognition that there's a developmental element to this, and that some of the information that Bruce just identified and has been important to the people that have given us a lot of input around this is that we don't have some of the risk factors being captured in the regular collection of information. But some of the parallel processes that are going on with health information exchanges and health information technology group, the Oregon group, that and the expansion of electronic medical records will actually give us, as we move down this road, an opportunity to become more robust with the data that we have to actually have better measures of risk.
Okay, Senator Shields and Senator Bates, then Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to how this plays out in Multnomah County, I would just, my experience in working in these kinds of endeavors, and perhaps you've had the same, is that big organizations tend to have the resources to send people to meetings on a regular basis, and providers who are seeing patients, 60 hours a week generally do not. So I would offer some caution to the board to not just give the Multnomah County process over to this private entity that, best I could tell, is includes some great people, but a heavy dose of representation from the insurance industry, as well as the hospitals who have a whole bunch of staff that can send people to meetings on a regular basis. So I'm not giving you any advice on doing that, but I would think that you want to be creative in figuring out how you can get some smaller providers, some smaller mm-hmm. specialists who don't have lobbyists working on their behalf, who don't have, even a one staff person they could spare because they're seeing patients so often, just in order to make Medicaid reimbursement work for them. So somehow, if you could try to encourage getting them at the table, make sure that at the end of the day, we don't come up with a plan and get all the way down to the 10-yard line just to find out that the way we're going to really use global budgeting is going to inure to the benefit of the people who are at the table.
Oh, thank you.
I'd like to direct this, I think, to Dr. Goldberg, but possibly others, and Mike Bonilla might be able to help us out too. We're talking about the risk-sharing issue here. We've been doing this for 10, 12 years. It is less than a perfect situation. Many people in this panel have been in the middle of those battles. I could sit down with three hospitals right now and three managed care plans and watch them go at it about what the real risk is and what the real costs are. And that's just for physical health. And we've all been in those battles, so you know what I'm talking about. I think you're stepping into a new world here. I think we need to recognize that this is going to be a very different kind of world. We're now talking about risk for mental health, drug and alcohol, physical health, which we have a lot of background and knowledge in, and actually some social issues, and something we've carved out, and frankly, I think it's probably a mistake, and that's long-term health care. Nursing homes, foster homes have been carved out of this bill. I think it's actually going to really impact what we're doing here also. So having said that, I know you're talking to actuaries, and you're talking to people about modeling these CCLs and what the real risk for them is, the real cost for them is. My guess is, from conversations I've had, nobody really knows absolutely what those risks are going to be, because no one's ever modeled an organization this big, this many interchanging parts. The potential for saving is really astronomical. As a provider, I'll tell you that. But the risk here is that if we don't do it, we don't have those savings. So conversation going on about risk and modeling that risk for a CCO right now. How far down the road have you gotten in that, and have you had any inkling yet that you have a firm handle on it?
Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's in the business. Yeah, no, Chair Mona Sanderson, Senator Bates, members of the committee, you're absolutely right that we're looking at organizations taking on a tremendous amount of new risk, mental health, and particularly we're looking at the physical health side of the dual eligibles, the Medicare expenditures. So we're right now looking at that, and we'll be back December and early January with some more specifics. But what I would say is we're looking at it in sort of a couple of different dynamics. One, to get to Representative Conger's point, I think the best way to what do you do about insolvency is not to get there, and to look at how we can set up the appropriate kinds of reserves and monitoring so that you don't end up in that particular situation. Secondly, I think we understand that different communities are going to be in have different abilities to take risk, and that this is something that we may not want to look at one size fits all. You know, what Eric Parsons didn't tell you is that he used to run the Standard Insurance Company and has a lot of experience in risk and reinsurance. And so part of what we're also beginning to explore is how we can look at not just how much risk and reserve people need, but also another tier where we might look at how we can establish some reinsurance pool so that those who can't initially take that kind of risk will be able to provide the care. So I think we're entering into this. The last piece is not only is there heightened risk, but there's less money. And we don't want to be in a position where we siphon more and more dollars off to just take care of the risk and not going into the care. So that's how we're approaching it as an agency and as a board.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes, but Representative Freeman.
I'll go quick, thank you. I just wanted to make a comment about the risk adjustment, and kind of what I see is the current system is that those areas of the country or communities that do well don't get rewarded for doing well. So we want to be awful careful moving forward. Maybe risk adjustment to start with to get everybody sort of on an even playing field. But moving forward, we want to be awful careful for those CCOs that figure out how to make a healthier population, that you don't punish them by risk adjusting all the money to those areas that aren't doing well.
Right.
Great reminder of the evolutionary nature of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Chair, for allowing me to sit in. I'm a little bit of a late player to this particular piece of the discussion, and I appreciate the focus on the physical health challenges and the complexity of that organization. As I've been a part of a couple of conversations quite recently, the piece that keeps sort of coming up is the role of addictions, chemical dependency, public health, all of those kinds of ancillary things. And in a very quick glance at your example of programs that could be included in the global budgets, that concern still is sitting with me because I see a lot of less than 1% in the column as to how much of the concern might be on some of those sorts of issues. At the same time, as I hear a lot of conversation about behavioral, the importance of behavioral modification and the overall success of a focus on preventative health and all of the rest of those kinds of concerns. So I'm not asking for a discussion of it now, but I just need to raise that issue that if we're in general looking at 70% on the physical health coverage side and then sort of parceling everything out below. Are we adequately taking into the behavioral health issues and modifications that will be necessary to make this a successful venture?
Can I just quickly, thank you for bringing that up, Representative Cowan. I think it's really important. And it gets to kind of what I was responding to with Senator Shields. There has been a tremendous amount of dialogue, at least in the Tri-County area, around these are the different businesses that we all have and what exactly are we need, do we need to learn about each other's business and what are the contributions of, if you will, these different businesses to the overall health of our communities. That being said, one of the advantages of if we do this right with a global budget is that some of those less than 1% areas can actually, with again making sure it's provider driven and consumer, you know, it's what the consumers want, that we can actually see some of that percentage of money moving to where they can keep people healthier and without disadvantaging everybody in the CCO. So that's like the kind of intellectual challenge that we have of how do we move that money without really with mitigating the negative impacts and then holding harmless as much as possible the institutions that are participating.
Let's move through the rest of your...
We really wanted to get some feedback on your thoughts around the quality incentives. We know that we want to focus on the outcomes, and I'm getting a little nervous here that we won't even get to the Quality and Outcomes Committee slides with our time. But really, we know that focusing on the outcomes will take time. And the last time we came to this committee, actually, Representative Greenlick, you know, pointed out, you know, the long-term strategies versus the interim strategies. And so the group that was working on global budget methodology and addressing this agreed that because these are new systems and we will have to look at it developmentally, we need to establish kind of a baseline and begin with a limited set of measures. That doesn't mean that they aren't going to be rigorous and that they aren't going to be able to be trackable, if you will, with the data that we have. And that the transition from process measures, which will have to come first, to outcome measures, has to be clearly outlined at the beginning, you know, so that we don't forget where we're going, which is healthier people, which is the outcome measure. So a system of accountability with carrots and sticks, which begins with performance incentives, and that kind of gets back to where you put the money and how you move the money around, and how do you introduce performance risk as the CCOs mature, and how do you establish this going forward? And we really, you know, we're hoping to get some thoughts from the committee on this, because this gets back again to the question that was asked: what do you do with poor performing organizations that Representative Conger brought up? You know, do you put more money in and you reward bad behavior, or do you provide technical assistance? Do you have some kind of, I don't know, receivership? You know, how do you respect the fact that the state is different in different areas, and if we do believe in local control, you know, how do we preserve that, but at the same time make sure that we're getting the quality that we need for the citizens? So I'm just going to open that up, if I can, for comments.
A little bit of each.
Keep moving at this point.
Yeah, I think this raises an important point, Madam Chair. Co-chair, is that we need a mechanism for you to get feedback from the committee. This is obviously not the mechanism. This is the place where we hope you could report to us and we could briefly comment. But I think we are trying to work on a way to get a different way to have some formal response from the committee to where you're going. And it will be easier to do when we have more of your plans. So.
That's right, absolutely.
You're getting a CD with all of the work from all of the work groups for your reading pleasure.
Mm. When?
Now. Okay.
Cool.
Yeah, rather than the three-ring binders.
I like three-ring binders. Like the, yeah. But okay. I can do that, too, so I don't worry.
So where are we now with our GLOBIT methodology? And Representative Cowan already discussed, the funding streams issue. Some of the key issues that we're still walking through are, where do we get the largest return on investment? How do we mitigate the impacts, which we know there will be impacts of major system change? And at the same time, how do we preserve, what's best in what we're now providing? The other committee that we had, the outcomes, quality, and efficiency metrics, you can read the principles and criteria that they have agreed upon. They're making really good progress. Again, they have the same challenge, that we do when we talk about how we're going to evaluate how people are spending their money in the global budget. We know we have to weigh the issue of process outcomes with ultimate health outcomes and stage them, but not make sure that we don't continue to work toward our goals. The group spent two or three meetings, we just want to call out and put that we have to really look at this in terms of three buckets. The core set, a menu which a CCO could choose from, and I think that this also reflects our commitment that epidemiology around the state is different. State has different institutions. Local places in the state have different institutions and different capacities so that they could choose what most reflects their capacity and their need in their community, and that they have, and then what are the transformational metrics that they're going after? So we're not just counting what we've already done and then counting it into the future, but what are the real transformational goals that we want to see that'll show that we've changed the system? Now I'm going to turn it over to Eric to talk about the dual eligibles.
Okay. As the guy who tries to keep the Health Policy Board meetings on track and on time, I will try to respect your situation here and move very quickly to the rest of the slides. With regard to Medicare, Medicaid integration, we all know there's tremendous opportunity for better outcomes and cost savings here. We think on the slide here you'll see we've identified some of the areas where that work is going. A lot of great work is going on. I'm not going to belabor it at this point, but it's clearly high on our radar screen, and we're moving through that. We'll have some, we think, very, very effective approaches to suggest to you. I did want to talk just for a minute or two on the medical liability issue. The Health Board is tasked with to come back to you with some ideas. I simply want to let you know that what we're trying to do here is to move from anecdote to data. We've hired some really top quality folks to help us think this through. Dr. Kate Becker was a member of the Council of Economic Advisors during the Bush administration. Dr. Michelle Mellow is also from Harvard and a very well-respected student in the area of medical liability. We're looking at a wide range of possible approaches, but we're going to come back to you with something that's based on some good. What I want to say, basically just some studies so that we can really understand what the issue is, how pervasive is the problem in terms of defensive medicine and so on, and what are really effective ways to try to deal with that. We think we've got some good ideas. We know we've got the right people on the case, and so we're working hard to come back to you with that. The final slide is the timeline. We have a Health Policy Board meeting on the 13th of December where we'll be reviewing draft of the business plan. As I said before, all of you are welcome to attend that in any of our meetings. We've got public comment period after that meeting. We've got a meeting in January 10 where we'll review a further draft, another public comment period after that. We'll be back here for interim legislative hearings in January. We'll approve of the deliverables that will come to you at our meeting, the Health Policy Board meeting, on the 24th of January. That was a meeting that we've added to the schedule. And we'll be back in February with the deliverables as required. Assuming that that we come back with something that makes sense to you and that there's an approval, we'll begin the implementation process immediately. OHA is looking forward to that opportunity, of course, and hopefully by July we'll be in the position to certify our first CCO. And so that very quickly gets us to the end of our deck at 9 o'clock.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate all the hard work being done. I've had the opportunity to attend a couple of those work groups, and there's good people there working hard. Large groups, and you have to go through that process to get where you're trying to get to. My concern, and a comment I'd like to make to the chairs here and to the committee, is that
when you step back sort of from the fog of war and look what's going on in healthcare in this state and how it affects our state budget and Medicaid, how it frankly affects our economy statewide and our business community, this is probably the biggest issue going on right now, potentially in state government from the point of view of budget and the point of view of how it affects our society as a whole. We're going to have to make some decisions in February on this. And I frankly feel, even though I'm deeply involved and a little less than comfortable about the amount of knowledge we have of what's going on, I believe we actually should meet again in December as a group and probably again in January as a group before we walk into February, because I think we need to have that information and we need to be spread widely in this group so we can talk to our colleagues about it. And I would press strongly that we, even though it's difficult, we're from all over the state, takes a lot of time to get everybody together. I realize the difficulty in doing that. I know the holidays are here, but meeting again in early December and meeting sometime in January, I think, is really a key in moving this process along and giving us a chance to sit down and talk. We've had 1 hour with you today. I could have asked you a dozen more questions. I didn't do that because we haven't got enough time for it. And we're going to spend another hour now on some other issues which are important, but they don't rise to the level, in my mind, of transformation. So I would ask the chairs to consider that.
And we had actually talked about that and am trying to come up with some dates. The second week doesn't work for certain groups. The third week didn't work. Then we're right onto the holidays. And I think to us, or at least to me, it's extremely important for you to have more of a product for us. And since you're meeting in December, I need to hear from you. I want to see the product. And so give us some feedback regarding timeline where, yes, December maybe, but I feel the health authority needs to get its act together to be able to give us more detailed information.
Madam Chair, I'm urging the House leadership, after they've had some discussions with the governor's staff, to try and schedule a meeting the week of Christmas, say on the 19th or something like that. And I think we need a whole day meeting.
Absolutely.
If that date can work, if we can get at least most of us
absolutely
together.
Yeah, we need.
13 is when we'll have the draft to you.
Right.
I really support what Senator Bates said.
Yeah, and not everybody can make these meetings during the holidays and in January. I realize everybody can't make
also
it.
I mean, that we can
it's vitally important
it
we do it.
Yes. Representative Greenlicker, you're talking, you have a specific date in mind.
I'm hoping the 19th of December will work as a date for us. I've heard the second and third week don't work, but we don't have anything else to do that week anyway.
some of us do.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I suggest that we talk about some date that week. But I think
some date that week.
I think it's important enough that I know for me I will make my schedule work for that. So
that's a Monday.
Representative Conger,
or Tuesday.
Representative Conger, you had a comment.
Tuesday, Wednesday.
I did. It was actually more or less a question, but I'll make it quick in the interest of time. I'll just assume that that the choices that I make as an individual are fairly relevant to the outcomes for me in terms of my health. And yet, in the slideshow, I didn't see, maybe I missed it, but I didn't see anything about the relevance of the behavior of the people who are participating in the CCO plan to the outcomes. Did I miss that, or are we working on that?
That was the Chair Mona Sanderson, Representative Conger, that was actually the topic of last night's meeting with the work group, was individual responsibility. And so it ended at 9 last night. We didn't quite have enough time, but it's one of the issues that is part of the plan as well. How do we work with that?
Great. Yes. Just briefly, thank you so much for being here, and I really appreciate all the work that you've done. One of the things that we've heard back, apparently we don't have the complexity that you've got over in Multnomah County, but we've got a lot of work going on in Lane County, and certainly throughout the rest of the state, where we have areas that are able to move forward earlier because we've got a history of collaboration and we've got everyone at the table, and I feel really good about that. The one concern people have is if communities are ready to go forward earlier because of the work that's been done, we want to make sure that those communities are not penalized either financially or having a different bar set just because we happen to be able to coordinate and collaborate earlier. So I would just put that on the table, and again, I'm sure you're aware of it, but it really is a concern and maybe holding some people back saying, gosh, if I'm all in, am I going to be penalized from, you know, against somebody else who it's just taking longer.
We hear you. Thank you.
Well, I'm very excited about the progress. I mean, I'm amazed at how much we have taken on, you have taken on, and I mean, we are on a fast track, and sometimes the devil is in the details, and I think that's some of the concerns that everybody is, worried about. And I know that December is really an important time for family, and I know that all of us will make every effort to be a part of this, and so it's going to be a balance act. We've already been talking, I have anyway, with the Senate President's office regarding timelines and meetings, and so we'll just let our staff work with you to figure out what would be the best time. Representative Thompson, you had something.
Yeah, I was just tagging on to what Representative Hoyle said about the preparation and timeliness. I would also caution you to think about the fact to move this through, we need majority votes of 90 legislators. And in the upcoming month, we are all going to be lobbied heavily by people in our own districts who are happy or unhappy with the direction this is going. And I can't stress enough the importance of having a really statewide plan, because the areas that are not ready, in my instance, are lobbying me heavily against moving this thing forward because they're not ready. And so we need to have some kind of a timeline, a plan, or something that will show the way for statewide readiness. And that goes back to your carrot and stick, but it doesn't appear that that doing nothing is possible. So therefore, we have to have some kind of a statewide plan on what we're going to do that makes sense and will bring warring parties together.
Good input. Thank you. And we will certainly work with your schedule in any way that we can. We appreciate your help, your support, and your questions, and to the extent that we can bring more information that's helpful to you, we're glad to do so.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. I'm excited and and overwhelmed. All right. The next agenda item is Creating Health Where We Live, Learn, Work, and Play. Doug Riggs, Craig Hostetler, and Dr. Nick Gideonis.
Chair Anderson and co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson, thank you very much for this opportunity to present on this important topic. For the record, my name is Craig Hostetler. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Primary Care Association. We're a nonprofit organization that serves community health centers who serve over 315,000 Oregonians across the state. And today we want to share with you the issues that we face when we treat folks with complex psychological and social issues. And we want to make the case for accounting for these complex psychological and social issues within the CCO construct as that gets developed. As you know, we don't know what the adjustment factors are yet. It's being worked on. And I'd like to acknowledge up front that this is a difficult topic. Nationally, I've been working with folks to come up with adjustments and metrics and payments to support addressing barriers to psychological and social issues. And there is no silver bullet out there, so it will take time to develop these. But nonetheless, we want this bill that we have in front of you to address that important issue as something that the CCO process is expected to come up with. In front of you, there is a Qualis paper that does reiterate the statement, you have that in your packet, that such factors need to be accounted for and that practices that care for highly complex patients psychologically and socially will be put at a disadvantage if quality metrics and payment don't account for these barriers to addressing good health. The other thing is that what we're hoping is this legislative concept doesn't have to come forward. If the CCO business plan does address it adequately, we're willing to pull this off the table. But if it doesn't, then what we want to do is bring this back for approval and hope we have your support. What we like about the House Bill 3650 is that it does foster a patient-centered approach. We're very excited about that. But it talks about treating the whole person and addressing and eliminating their barriers to health. We applaud these directives and as many of the Oregonians across the state that actually face psychological and social barriers to achieving better health. I think this is a direct line to actually improving health access and decreasing health disparities across the state. One thing that we know through research is that very little of the health determinants are based on our healthcare system. 90%, in fact, aren't based on the healthcare system. They're based on other patterns, such as behavioral patterns. Accounts for 40% of health determinants within a population. Social circumstances, such as homelessness, lack of employment or education, rural isolation, and social isolation, account for 15% of the determinants of health. Another 10% is based on the healthcare system, and the remaining 30% is based on genetic predisposition. So there's a lot there that can impact the health outcomes of a patient. People who face psychological and social barriers have rarely have the right tools to make good health choices, and they suffer needlessly through prolonged periods and eventually call 911 and end up in the emergency room in expensive hospitalization. These are many of the patients at the community health centers that I work with and other safety net and other providers actually serve. And they present these healthcare providers with far more complex and time-intensive issues than do most patients. But with the right interventions, we can improve their health and lower the overall cost of care. So as we move forward in transforming the system, I call you back to the research paper from Qualis Health that notes the importance of accounting for the psychological and social barriers, both in establishing measurements and paying for additional time and resources to address barriers to health. And with your permission, Chair Anderson, I'd like to show a brief video that highlights this point.
Policymakers need to understand that, you know, there are these special circumstances, situations that we're dealing with the patients that we're taking care of.
My name is Kurt Hall, and I'm 54. I drove a truck for 23 years. That's all I ever did. When I got into my late 40s and early 50s, I started having health problems that just completely turned my life upside down. I lost my job, I lost my health insurance, I eventually became homeless, and I had some friends of mine said, well, go down to Old Town Clinic. And so I came down, and Dr. Rachel Solotaroff became my primary care doctor. They are very passionate about the job that they do, they're very serious about it, and they changed my life.
My name is Susan, and I'm 43 years old, and I've been an addict for 32 years. I lost my dignity, I lost my teeth. I had no respect for myself. Someone briefly told me about this program. And I can say that I have my own apartment today. I have my family back. I have my son's respect. And he tells me, I love you today, Mom, for doing what you're doing. I'm a miracle today. I'm a survivor. I'm who I am today because of this program.
My name is Alice Tucker. I found out I have COPD, bronchitis, emphysema, and chronic asthma. And with the help of Rachel and people at the program, I mean, they work with you. They really give you chances and help you get housing, medical, whatever you need to keep you off that street, they will do that for you. I transformed into a grown woman, actually, a more responsible adult.
Homelessness, criminality, lack of employment, lack of education, chronic mental illness.
You're trying to get all these visits to the door to make your budget ends meet, and then you're doing all this other service, which is really more helpful to the health status of the patient, and that's non-billable.
The problem with our system now is that the way the day is divided up is still in 20-minute increments. Even if it makes the most sense for me to spend 2 hours with the patient focusing on a very complex medical condition, we can't do that. I still have to truncate that 2-hour visit into 20 minutes so I can stack up all these other visits.
Right now, healthcare kind of works on this widget production model where you're paid for a primary care provider to see a patient face-to-face, and that's really the only thing that gets paid.
One of the beauties of this clinic and of this agency as a whole is that the needle that we're always trying to move is hospitalizations and emergency room visits. And it's been shown by lots of research that communities with strong primary care systems avoid hospitalizations as well as emergency room visits, so that we eliminate waste, eliminate redundancy.
What's lacking is the definition of how are we going to reform payment so that these clinics can really provide the quality of care to the patients that they need.
Patients who are served by the safety net present specific challenges, and we need to figure out how to make sure that our quality metrics make sure that we use the data in a way that respects those differences. I would just like to have a more thoughtful dialogue about how are we making people healthier, and let's measure the things that are really helping to improve people's health. We really want to push on a payment system that rewards good quality care, and the assumption is that the data will be there to do all of that. And in fact, we're still at some pretty early stages. It's going to take us a little while to get where we want to be. That doesn't mean we drag our feet. We can get started. We just need everyone to come to the table and be very thoughtful and collaborative about how we use data to really drive the kind of change we want.
So I think it's helpful to see a video clip to highlight that, so it really makes the case. I want to be clear, what we're not saying is that we're setting different benchmarks for health outcomes. We're not trying to get them. We're trying to get them to the same point. The thing we are saying is it's going to take more time and resources to get them to the benchmarks that we're trying to achieve for populations that face psychological and social barriers. The other thing that's in your packet is there's a JAMA article, this is a Journal of American Medical Association, that makes this point. If quality or paying for value doesn't account for adjustments for these conditions or barriers that people face, then it can increase health disparities, and that's an unintended consequence that we've seen through some pay for performance things going on nationally. So our hope, again, is that we don't have to move this legislative concept forward, that the business plan from the CCO work that's going on actually addresses this, but if it does, we hope to have your support. But I do want to turn it over to Dr. Nick Gideons, I have trouble with that too, and so he can give you a frontline perspective of what he's seen.
Thanks, Greg. Thank you, Co-Chairs Miles Anderson, Greenlick, and Thompson, other members of the committee. My name is Nick Gideons. I'm the medical director at OHSU's Richmond Clinic. I work closely with all four of OHSU's four family medicine clinics, also in Scappoose and Gabriel Park and in the South Waterfront neighborhood, as they have done this hard work of transforming into the patient-centered medical home model. I also work with trainees going into primary care and medical students contemplating a career in primary care, and that keeps me very future-oriented in terms of how can we bring the tools to bear to make this a doable project and to leverage the work we need to do to make the CCO successful and make this model of care work. I'm here today also because I have extensive experience with patients who face psychological and social barriers to health. My career has been in underserved and low-provider areas. I was a rural physician for 8 years in Cottage Grove, Oregon. In fact, just this last weekend, I spent 48 hours covering John Day's emergency room and hospital, and I want to say for sure that these issue of risk adjustment and accounting all the psychosocial factors of health is certainly not simply an urban issue at all, but it's a key factor in getting the outcomes and cost savings we all want from coordinated care and from the whole system reform. And I'm also speaking from the perspective of having spent about 5 years in a learning collaborative really developing ourselves into the PCPCMH or patient-centered medical home model. I'm happy to say that sort of at our initial scoring on these really nice criteria that have been put up, we think we're about at level 3. So I speak from a place where we think we've got plenty of work to do, but we've moved forward in this way. So in my clinic, we're seeing about 9,000 patients a year, the majority uninsured or Medicaid, dual eligible, but also a cohort of insured patients, which is OHSU employees and Medicare as well. As we begin to develop the tools to count for psychosocial risk adjustment, we're seeing that while most of our patients will have a single psychological or social barrier to health, over 40% have at least two, which are barriers to not just access and making good personal choices about health, which you heard can influence maybe 40% of the outcome, but also just navigating the system and the degree to which language and other barriers to self-care can occur or to providing the care. And I'm going to tell a story about that right now. James is a 58-year-old diabetic with recurrent abscesses in his legs. He's a pretty abrasive personality, has bipolar affective disorder that during his periods of mania have burnt a lot of his bridges, left him socially isolated and living in his car. The cycle of frequent visits in the clinic, doing what we can to keep him out of the emergency room and hospital with some success, really, but it's this frequent cycle, poor self-care, can and only does end when his housing situation stabilizes. We can be doing things like refrigerate his insulin in a reliable way, get stable access to mental health services, some of which we can supply, but which again only get really stable when you begin to have a housing plan in place. Until then, tolerating frequent missed appointments, tolerating poor hygiene, tolerating non-adherence or non-compliance with the plan that we would like to outlay with him, some of which he can and some of which he needs help navigating, would really strain a traditional straightforward fee-for-service and even more so a purely outcomes-based, as in is his diabetes under control or not, would really strain a system like that unless you can do some adjustment on those kinds of outcomes or on the needs basis of it. And the article you have from JAMA talks about how grading in the measures that we have of physicians' quality of care, systems' quality of care, really changes when you begin to adjust for that. Like Craig, I believe that health outcome metrics for all patients should be the same. Providers need to be held accountable for what they do. Whatever percentage of your practice, all of us have some, in your practice, have significant barriers to health. But I also believe that we have to recognize that it's going to take more time and resources to work in that way, to care for patients like James who are facing these kind of barriers. And without adjustments, you'll end up with some very odd things, particularly the common phenomena, something I remember somewhat from the 90s, of the cherry-picking aspect and running away from the patients who are most going to benefit from the cost savings that will most likely occur from deep engagement. So in closing, I'd like to thank you for taking the testimony, encourage you to visit the community health centers in your community, OHSU Richmond, if that's convenient for, meet some of our patients and providers, hear more about how we want to work with this stuff, and how important psychosocial risk adjustment would be. Thank you very much.
Just a quick question. I'm sure you've been at the table of the Oregon Health Policy Board subcommittees addressing this issue. And I would hope that you would be presenting these things to them. I mean, what we don't want is different factions going off into their own, in their own direction without looking at the overall picture. So don't you think this is a little early?
Chair Montes-Anderson, yes, we are on the committees, and we are presenting this information to the committees, presenting it to folks like Dr. Bruce Goldberg and Mike Bonetto and others. I think the issue is we want to make sure that we have a place for a legislative fix if it doesn't address it, because this is such a fundamental piece of payment. We heard in the last presentation that, you know, risk adjustment is key, and within risk adjustment for these vulnerable populations, adjustments for psychological and social barriers is key. So we hope that it does resolve itself there and that we don't have to bring this legislation forward, but we don't want to have that be the last thing, because if it fails there, we need another avenue to bring this forward.
Okay.
Well, thank you. Last night's meeting was about 3 hours on outlier groups. And there's all kinds of phrases we use for this group of people, people with barriers, special needs, outliers. But we're all talking about the same group of people. And right now, they're the 20%. They're chewing up 80% of the healthcare dollars, whether we like to admit that or not. And they're doing it through ERs and repetitive hospital visits. So we're all talking about the same group of people. These people need intensive management. Social, mental health, drug and alcohol, and physical health. And right now what we do is, as we've talked about over and over again, silo up. But I can give you a story from my practice this week. We're going to spend $250,000 on a particular individual, and his problem is he's in a foster home and needs to be in a nursing home. That's his only problem. We worked for 2 weeks to get him into a nursing home and not been able to do it. He's still in a foster home. He's going to be shipped to the state hospital for $300,000 a year pretty quick if we don't make that change. This is where we have to put our efforts. So what I'm asking here is, what you're talking about is absolutely correct, but I think it needs to be inside a CCO. And the CCO has to have that understanding of that and focus on those patients and really get them in situations where they have housing, which you mentioned, and appropriate support for whatever it is that they need, whether they take their medications or their mental health visits or whatever it is. And right now we do not have that in the state. It's all over the place. And as I said to you, Craig, I can deal with about two of these patients a day in my practice. You give me 15, and at the end of the day, I'm going to need emotional help and be in a nursing home, okay? These are you have no idea how difficult these people are if you haven't dealt with them on a regular basis. And you said the personality was abrasive? That's a nice understatement, okay? Mm-hmm. Very difficult situations. And if you think we can just tell them you have to be responsible yourself for it as an individual, it's not going to happen. They're going to keep going to our emergency rooms and our hospitals and get treated, because that's the way the system is set up. So what I'm asking for you to do is, I'm not saying you shouldn't bring legislation forward, but I think it should be in the context of the CCO. I think the chair is absolutely right. If we start slicing this thing up again, we'll be back where we were before. But your point is well taken. This is the population we're talking about. This is who we need to deal with.
Rep. Thompson.
We started the conversation on transformation about community health care and getting communities to work together for the provision of better health care for a better cost, better outcomes. And I don't think we got stuck up too fast on the $1.3 billion we're cutting out of the system, and that's certainly there. But I'm a little concerned when I hear your presentation. I was very excited about the concept of including mental health and drug addiction in healthcare. I think it's a huge step forward. But when we get into the details of this, do you feel that at your level of healthcare provision, you're being listened to in the CCO discussions and the transformation discussions? And I ask that because of another reference. One of the counties I represent, Polk County, a small rural county, we have 595 Medicaid providers in that county, which I thought was a high number, but I've got their names and addresses, so I'm relatively sure they exist. And that represents about 40 groups in, using the state classification system of healthcare providers. And yet, much of what I'm hearing is discussions about the role of IPAs in hospitals. And I'm a little concerned that we're launching into something where we may not be looking at the true picture on the ground. Just like your comments on where you...
Sure.
It's a loaded question, I know it.
Chair Anderson, Co-Chair Thompson. It varies by community because since the CCO is a local solution, in some communities, the community health centers are at the table. When they get invited to table is also key. Sometimes we get invited once the plan's been shaped and then can weigh in on it. Sometimes we're invited when the plan is getting shaped. And so we've been working with members across the state to really participate in the CCO structure and formation, and we're really looking at the governance criteria and what the provider representation on the governance structure is going to be at the end of the day, because I think you're right, that's a key to is the transformation going to happen and will money flow to the areas of the system we know it needs to flow to in order to affect change.
Chair Martin Anderson, Co-Chair Thompson, I also want to say that my expertise and my concern is about the vulnerable populations and just as much about the vulnerable primary care systems or the community-embedded providers. Whatever percentage of that group you just described is already engaged in this group or could be more engaged in this group needs to be watched out for, as Senator Bates was saying, needs to be encouraged, not disincentivized, so that will act and engage. It won't succeed without that. So I'm agreeing with everyone that this can happen very well at the level of the CPO, at the level of the local community, but if we're not watching, it can also happen not so well. And that's why I'm here today.
And I'm sure we're going to have some growing pains, too.
Absolutely.
Further discussion?
I think I'm so glad that you're here. I think that, you know, we need to have a bunch of different options on the table if we don't end up in the CCO framework where we want to go. The one thing that I would also underline is the problem that Dr. Bates is talking about is even more important for providers who are just out there on their own doing their best to see really, really challenging Medicaid patients because they don't get kind of the super reimbursement that the FQHC will get. So when, a very antisocial client doesn't show up for a half-hour appointment with a primary care provider in private practice, it's like a triple whammy to them, and it encourages them to say, well, look, I'm just going to have to, you know, not bring this patient back. They're going to have to go somewhere else. So
we need to move on.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you very much, and glad that you brought this issue forward, because I think we all care about that. Definitely. All right. Rocky King, Health Insurance Exchange, and Drew.
Hey, Rocky, we need to hear whether the story we heard about your grandkid is really true.
Pardon?
See, we also need to know whether the story we heard about your grandson is really true.
Yes, we do.
It's on the computer.
I don't know how to do it.
Well, then Kelly needs to help you.
Oh, my God.
We can go through this. Chair Mona Sanderson, co-chairs, vice chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King, and I'm the executive director for the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange, and I'm really pleased today to have two people with me that are playing an very important role in, as we move forward, and I want to introduce them and give an opportunity.
Can we take those conversations outside, please?
Yeah, thank you. Just hit the arrow. We'll take an opportunity for them to just tell you who they are. And it's Liz Baxter, first of all, is the chair of the board for the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange, a consumer representative. And Terry Andrews, who is the vice chair of the board, representing small business. She's an engineer, a patent attorney, a small business owner. And they do a lot of work for which they do not get paid. I do a little work for which I get paid. But I'll let them say a few words to you if they would like.
I am so honored to have been named to this exchange board, and other than always being incredibly...
Introduce yourself.
Oh, Chair Monis Anderson and co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson. My name is Liz Baxter, and I am the executive director of the Archimedes Movement and We Can Do Better, and now the chair of the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Board. And other than always being incredibly intimidated to be introduced along with a patent attorney and an engineer, you know, the members of the board are just an incredibly talented and diverse group, and I think bring just the right mix of perspectives to the discussions that we're going to be having. And, you know, just very excited to be working on the business plan that you're going to be getting to see in the next month, and wanting to make sure that this exchange that gets built is sustainable and successful and the best that Oregon can create. So thank you for the honor of being on this board, and we look forward to more conversations with you. Yeah, personally intimidating.
It's hard to imagine. Good morning. My name is Terry Andrews, and I'm very new to this process, but I'm serving as the vice chair on the board, and I am a small business owner, and this is quite a task that's before all of us. And I think that, as Liz has mentioned, the board is very diverse, and I think they've got a very exciting group of people that are all working hard to make this a reality. And right now we're following Rocky's lead, and he's working hard, we're all working hard. So I appreciate the opportunity as well, and I look forward to more of the same. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Rocky King, the executive director of the Health Insurance Exchange. In talking with some of you to get some idea of what to give you as an update, this doesn't really flow very well. It covers four or five different things. I'll give you a quote. We'll talk to you about some of the groups we're meeting with, what's been going on, what keeps me up late at night, the value of the exchange from some consumers and small business perspective, and key milestones, as well as what's coming to the soon to the theaters near you. We've been working with a variety of firms and around communications, and we actually asked people to come in and tell us what they were thinking. And here was a quote that we received from Sandstrom's Partners, who we think we're going to be working with quite closely over the next year in developing some messaging. But they said, "Our assumption is the exchange is being born in a political battlefield. Half of Oregon never wanted you to exist, and the other half wanted much more than what you are." And that's what we feel often when we go out there, is we got half the people who say, you know, Obamacare, go away, the other half that say you can't just be a Travelocity, you have to be more. So what one of the tasks that we're trying to do is develop really the credibility and the trust and the good information so that we can be really zeroing in to build the base in the middle and begin to convince people that we do add value and can add value to the healthcare system. So it was a great quote, and I wanted to share it with you. We've been reaching out. It isn't just a bunch of staff meeting in a room or some contractors. We have the exchange board meetings, which, as you know, are public. We have an individual individual small employer and consumer advisory committee. It's really a group of 21 people throughout the state who come together, who on a variety of different issues are giving feedback to the board, directly to the board, mission, vision. I met with them Monday. They talked about standards of participation, you know, what are the kind of quality things they're looking for the health plans. They talked about the role of navigators and how different they would see that really aligning with the exchange, how agents may come in or not come in from their views, and you have a variety of different views. We don't ask this committee to take a vote. What we want them to do is lay out options and viewpoints so that we can put those in front of the board and they can hear all different sides. We have SHOP is, for those of you who don't remember, the Small Employer Health Insurance program of the exchange, where small employers can purchase health insurance. We've had probably 10 or 12 or maybe 8 to 10 meetings with technical meetings with carriers and small business folks to start really putting the bricks together on how to build that. We, in December, are putting together an actuarial advisory work group to really look at some of the risks selection and reinsurance issues around both the exchange, but also how the exchange then fits into the larger market to make sure that we, you know, have a level playing field inside and out. And we're also looking at, you know, the Consumer Advisory Committee has 21 people from small business and individuals, but we really need to have a larger group of special populations, some of the ethnic and minority populations. So we're really developing some additional consumer groups that we're starting to look at and how we're going to interact with them. And then finally, starting in December and January, we're putting together some agent advisory work groups to help us figure out how we can work in their local communities with small businesses and individuals, really developing the some of the outreach things. What we're focusing on, storyboarding, technical and data elements and requirements. And the best way to describe that is you got an iPhone, and that iPhone has an operating system, and OHA and Carolyn Larson and their group are really putting all the infrastructure together. And then what you have above all of the iPhone is Senate Bill 99, which is kind of a vision. And what we're trying to do is take that vision and put it on storyboards, just like you're making The Godfather. What does each scene look like? Eligibility, plan enrollment, billing and payments, agents, navigators. We're kind of in the process of drawing the storyboards, and that will really result in the applications that go into that onto that iPhone. So it's really interesting. If you take a piece of paper and say, what do you need to do to enroll, and start listing all of the different processes, all the different information, the information you need, where do you get it, the information you want to pull out of that, how does that connect to the next system? That's probably the biggest task that we're involved in right now. Coming out of that will be about 3,000 business requirements that we'll then sit down with the IT people and say, build this into the system. And that this will be an iterative process that really over the next year that we're involved in. IDO, User Interface Project. If you read Steve Jobs' biography, in the first 50 pages, they talk about 1974 when he designed the Apple One. I think it was the Apple One. He said, we've got to have something with a good user interface. He called a guy in San Francisco that ran a company called IDO. They are the best in the class for coming up with the user interfaces for all these systems. How many clicks should it take you to get to what the question is you ask's answer? They are really good. They're probably the best in the country in terms of user interface. They are working with 10 states to really model kind of what some of the ideas are around in the exchange and the internet portal. And they're looking at Oregon, perhaps, is a little bit closer and actually partnering with us to come up with a one model that we can then kind of modify and make a little bit more Oregon-oriented, but we're really excited about that. We do have an interim website that's, unfortunately, orhix.org. We'll come up with a name at some point. We're working with our communications people on that, and we'll get that website address to you to announce meetings. You can see what we're doing in terms of some of the work groups and the board. Project management. management, well, that's just basically what it says. We're just managing this project, and it's taken a lot of good staff time on that. Communication strategy, you know, there's really three or four elements to communications. One is the planning, the second is the staging, and the third is marketing and outreach and really getting the information out there. Everybody wants to know about the exchange, but I have to remind them it's 2011. We're really in the planning process. You'll start to see a stage of this probably the latter part of next year. Staging means you start training your folks, you start really putting the pieces together, so when you turn that key, everything goes at once. So we're really in the early still planning stages of the communications in terms of the general public. Financial modeling, you'll see that at your January meeting, where we'll show you all the financial modeling we've been doing around both the enrollment projections as well as the costs and the revenue and the expenses for the next two or three years, projecting out all the assumptions that we're making, and that will be obviously an integral part of the business plan. Some of you will turn to that page when you first get the business plan. And finally is the business plan development, which is part of that financial modeling. We'll have some drafts that will start coming out in the next 2 to 3 weeks that you'll get a chance probably to look at, but we'll have some official discussion at our meeting in January. What keeps me up late at night, just so you know why some of us can't sleep, is the impact of the 2014 federal market reforms. You can't build an exchange in isolation. There's a market that's going to be kind of turned in different directions. Some people think upside down, some people say sideways. The reality is it's a market that's designed theoretically to get 35 million U.S. citizens insurance who are not covered now. And in Oregon, there's going to be some impact on rates. It's going to be an impact of the benefits. And we need, I think, over the next, we'll get through the next 2 or 3 months, but I think some of the summertime and early springtime is going to have to be spent with this committee, with the insurance division, as well as OHA, as well as the exchange, talking about and beginning to put on the table some of those impacts so we can develop strategies and tactics to address the negative ones and hopefully build on the positive ones. The technical challenges of a shop exchange. It is really difficult to do something that's not being done, and I think I've shared with you what we want to be able to do through a defined contribution program for small employers is go to them and say, here are 7 carriers, here's 4 or 5 plans for each carrier, you define how much you want to contribute for your employee, and let your employee then choose your carrier and the plan they want. That brings a lot of technical issues around billing, premium setting, risk management, and I will tell you, I'm just very pleased with the carrier community who are trying to figure out this, because nobody does it today in Oregon. We want to be the first out there. We've talked about not having the final decisions around all the federal proposed rules around eligibility, around Medicaid, around the exchange in general, agents and navigators, and we don't even have the proposed rules yet on the essential benefit packages. Those are creating really some tension with us, because a large part of the exchange design is going to have to be dependent upon how those rules come out. And we'll have flexibility, but we want to be careful we don't go in a direction that all of a sudden they say you need to go in a different direction. Rules of the game, as we move forward, we want to make sure that the market outside the exchange is operating under the same rules as the market inside the exchange. And we're starting to identify some of the differences that may come out, and some of them are very subtle, that we're going to have to at some point lay before you and have you make some policy decisions and or at least have some discussion with us. And finally is the political stakes in the ground. It's just very difficult sometimes to build from that middle and build out, and we ask people to loosen the stakes and kind of watch us as we go along and develop this. Don't pound the stake too far into the ground. Value of the exchange. had 21 folks sitting around a table for 8 hours, consumers and small business representatives, people on OMIP, people in Medicaid, people that own medium-sized companies, self-employed, some community organizations. And this wasn't all of what they came up with, but this kind of echoes some of their thoughts. Eligibility integration with Medicaid, no wrong door. People come in and you don't have to be given another phone number, never another website to go to. We'll take care of that behind the scenes. Access to tax subsidies and other assistance for either small businesses or individuals under 400% of poverty level. Plan comparison and ease of enrollment. They can actually put up there and look at four different carriers and the plans. Carriers won't come up based on how much they paid the internet broker to put theirs up front, like in Google. It'll be based on just what interests the people have that are on the exchanges. Your doc, the primary thing, is it price? You'll be able to put that in and hopefully bring up the plan so you can look at them. Plan standards, grading, and scorecard. We hope to have a grading system that everybody can agree to, so there's actually a score attached to carriers and plans. For employers, the keys, defined contribution, carrier choice, Section 125, all of that can come together. Community-based assistance through navigators, insurance agents, and longer-term focus, obviously, on cost, and that should say cost, value, quality. How do we begin to integrate this with the good work we're doing and the ideas that are coming out with House Bill 3650? What are the CCO's role going to be as it relates to this? Are there going to be co-op plans? How do we fold those in? We can put this together, but as we always say, if we don't have a little bit longer-term range around quality, value, cost, we'll be in trouble. Key reminder of milestones, business plan presented to you folks, I think in January of 2012. You'll have a chance to look at drafts before that to give us feedback. Presented to the legislature in February of 2012. We need to have federal certification in January of 2013. Outreach and marketing enrollment, we're really thinking July of 2013 with open enrollment occurring in October. Coverage begins January 1. I put in here that quarterly federal gateway reviews. On Monday I met with 21 consumers, business owners. On Tuesday I went to a meeting with 40 contractors, IT folks, people from HHS, CMS, the feds, OSIO that's managing the exchanges. And it was really interesting. You've got the first group that's talking, they're the people on the street, and you've got the second group that are really the IT folks putting the pieces together. Our job at the exchange is really to bring those two together, to bring the dreams and aspirations of the people on the street that you heard about in some of the testimony here with really the IT people that are trying to design the system that really supports them getting to the access for the care and the things that they need out of the medical system. But they do a quarterly federal review of how we're going. And I should tell you, yesterday's report that came back to us at the end of 8 hours was, other than Massachusetts, we are probably one of the top two states in terms of how far along we are. They identified issues and problems that we need to address and things they're concerned about. But we all walked out of that room, and I wasn't there for the whole day, but the staff from OHA and the exchange and DHS were there. And they walked out feeling pretty good, pretty challenged that we've made as much progress in the last 4 or 5 months as we have. So many important decisions, eligibility, determination, how is it going to be handled? We got probably 40% of the people coming through the system that won't go to the internet. How are you going to handle that? How are we going to coordinate outreach and marketing with both Medicaid and the commercial side? Who's going to operate the call center and customer service? Contract out, in-house? Is it one center? Is it two separate centers? Plan standards and requirements, things that we've talked about in depth and what those are going to be, the essential benefits, and finally, how do we put together a meaningful agent and navigation program. coming to theaters near you soon. And I think in January, February, you're going to start, in March, start hearing this, is what are we going to do about the reinsurance and risk adjustment modeling? The federal rules hopefully will be finalized by then. We're going to look at how that's going to impact our market. Secondly, we're working with the insurance division right now to look at a market reform impact analysis so we can really say, based on our thinking and the thinking of a lot of good actuaries, here's what we think the market's going to look like in Oregon in 2014, and key policy decisions that you may want to make that comes out of that analysis. And then finally, obviously, the draft business plan. So that's a, as you well know, I could spend 5 hours on this or 10 minutes. That's a quick overview that everything that's been going on. I want to thank you.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Thank you. I think you've been somewhat optimistic, Rocky. I think Sebelius has missed two-thirds of her deadline so far in the act, and so to think that we're going to have any sort of definitional things may be somewhat optimistic. So one question would be, if they don't, you know, if we don't know what the different levels are going to be, how do we proceed from there?
Yeah. Chairman Sanderson, Vice Chair Cruz, it really interesting because yesterday in the discussions with some of the federal folks, one of the things they finally, I think, are saying and they said to us was, we realize that we're behind on some things and that what, I mean, everybody is, 50 states, including us, including everyone. It's just the nature of the game. But one of the things they said, which is interesting, was identify those key elements that you need an answer to. And tell us what the answer is. Let us look at it. And if it's reasonable, we may have to give you the okay to move forward without having a final decision from the federal government. What I've instructed my staff to do and working with all the different elements is we need to land and start building it. And if we have to adjust it and modify it, we'll do that later. But I can't hold up doing the job for them to make decisions. The last thing I'd like to say, as you probably know, we will, Teresa Miller's going back to her. I have her cell number. I will call her when I'm really mad and upset that they haven't given us an answer.
Becca, just to follow up, because I'm meeting with you in a little while, we can get in more details on some of this stuff. I was just somewhat distressed when you were talking iPhone, because I have a Windows phone, so I don't know how that's going to work.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rocky, just a couple quick questions, and really it's a long-term thing. I'm not going to ask about whether this whole thing falls apart in the Supreme Court, all the other stuff that can happen. I'll make some assumptions that's not going to happen. But I want to ask a couple questions. One, are you working with LFO? I mean, from my point of view, the two big risks here are, first, the IT component. We've had a mixed at best history of IT in this state. I can point to some that have worked and some horrendous failures. So are you working with LFO on the IT component? That's one question. The other question is, we're opening up a huge market for commercial carriers here if this goes through the way we hope it will. And I'm hoping they're right there with you in lockstep, working with you and talking about this, because they're going to be key players in this, in getting this market going. I mean, we're talking about everything above, I believe, last I heard, was 138% of the federal poverty level. And I know you've talked about kind of controlling that the first couple of years of 50 employers and less and trying to keep that down. Has there been a discussion about opening it up wider right from the get-go? I mean, the demand out there in the public for this and from small employers is really huge. People want help on this. They want it now. If you had a discussion with carriers, can we go past what you're kind of thinking about of 50 and less the first couple of years and then up to 100 employees later? Can you talk about possibly moving it forward directly and immediately?
Yeah, Chairman Sanderson, Senator Bates, in terms of the IT, first of all, OHA, who's managing that project for us, and there's a consortium of really four agencies, the Exchange, DHS, Insurance Division, and OHA, kind of have the overreaching management of that. Bruce Goldberg, myself, was Teresa Miller, and Aaron Kelly Seal. So we meet and receive the reports as well as what's happening in our own organizations. Bob, I think it's Bob Cummings.
Bob Cummings.
Is extremely involved, brings just great objective oversight. And a kind of a sense of cynicism or caution, I should say, which is exactly what his role should be. I know Carolyn is presenting to the Audits Committee today and also the Ways and Means Subcommittee on kind of a project update, so I'll let her kind of talk about that. This whole thing rises or falls on whether that system works. And I should say it, whenever I say around the staff that are building this, if the system works, they correct me. It's going to work. I am really impressed with it. We're going to see in March our first prototype that we're building internally. We've already seen some of the elements of that prototype. So we're behind because it's not there, but we're getting there, and I think it's going to be good. The hardest thing is bringing on some of the assets we need to build this. Both from my perspective, I need people that can understand health insurance, premium payments and billing and plan management and agent reimbursement or whatever it may be, enrollment. I need specialists to understand that, but who also can kind of put the application together. And what they need, they've got the programming people, and they need the same thing. They need the program people so that when we talk to them and say, this is what we need, they can understand it. So that's one of the biggest challenges we have, and we're working on that. I'm just bringing on board a man from Intel to help us really manage some of the skill sets in our office a little bit better than we've been doing. So we're working on that. On the carrier side, you're right. We are really trying to develop a variety of partners, whether it's a community organization, whether it's the carrier. Those are critical. I think the market impact analysis that we want to do in February, March of this year will give the answer to your question, is it time to expand? And we're also looking at the federal government is going to do a new study to look at potential enrollments by state and what's going to happen in the individual and group markets. You put that together with our reform impact analysis, and I think the question of whether we go to 100 gets answered sometime next year.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Kennemer and then Representative Greenick, and we need to close up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know that we need a lot of discussion about it. Senator Bates alluded to it. I was just surprised the Supreme Court wasn't on your insomnia list. Because I think it has to do fundamentally with the funding issue.
Yeah. Chairman Sanderson, Representative Kennemer, they're going to make a decision. And that decision is going to have some impact. It's either move forward or not move forward. If it's not move forward, then my sense is that the governor, the legislature, and the exchange will be before you with a variety of policy decisions. I should say that the exchange idea, it has a long history in Oregon. A lot of people call this Obamacare. That's a misnomer. It really is Oregon Care. It's something that really grew out of the legislative debate about what we should do to assist the access of health insurance for Oregon citizens. Whether we can afford to go forward is going to be a policy question, and in what manner we would go forward or not go forward, that the legislature and the governor's office are going to have in discussion next year.
In Washington State.
And Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, I would just like to comment there. I mean, the basic issue is individual mandate, and there's nothing in Senate Bill 99 that even talks about individual
mandate. That's right.
Rocky, I have maybe a caution rather than a question. Mm-hmm. There were two major issues in the House debate on Senate Bill 99. One was the nature of the health insurance board, the exchange board, and I think even the most skeptical will think the board really came out very well without our in that. But the other question was the extent to which the exchange could be negotiating on behalf of the consumers for better health insurance rates. And, you sort of scoffed at Velocity, the Travelocity, but I go to Travelocity to find out what the best price is because I know they're negotiating prices. Then I go off and do something else. But the issue is going to be the extent to which the citizens believe you're representing the insurance industry as a way of helping them market as opposed to representing consumers as a way of helping them get the best deal on insurance. And I mean, that's in the wind. I'm sure you hear about it, and I think it's, I hope from the folks I hope the answer is going to be, we're here to help consumers with or without federal subsidies or anything else get the very best deal on the insurance they could possibly get. You can comment on that, or Liz can perhaps.
Chair Monis Anderson and Co-Chair Greenlake, I think that where the board is certainly heading is that part of the responsibility of the exchange is to use its leverage in any way that it can. And that, you know, using the term negotiating, I think, kind of brings to mind different things for different people. But ending up with lower premiums, you know, I think that that's certainly on the list. But that leverage can take a lot of different directions, and that part of our expectation is both that the corporation and the staff are going to find all of the possible ways to leverage.
Thank you.
Okay, no further discussion. Stay tuned, I guess.
Yes, stay tuned.
And we'll be hearing from you in January. All right.
Thank you.
Next item is payment parity for nurse practitioners, Susan King, Shelter Holmes, and John Ross. And if you can keep your presentation to 15 minutes, that would be great.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Susan King. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Nurses Association. I appreciate the opportunity to bring you an update today on an issue of concern to many providers across the state. Just by way of context, I don't want to take a lot of time from my two colleagues. I'd like to recap what the issue is. We first became significantly aware of problems with provider reimbursement policies on the part of carriers in the summer of 2009, when first one and then another major carrier in the state made a decision to drastically reduce the reimbursement rates for mental health care delivered by non-physician providers. That obviously had a significant impact on an aspect of our healthcare delivery system, community mental health, that is already significantly undersourced and stressed. Since that time, we have seen some of the carrier policies spread not only to specialty care in the area of mental health, but also decisions around reimbursement of primary care providers, specifically making a decision that reimbursement rates for nurse practitioners and clinical specialists providing the same service as their physician colleagues will be less. In the 2000 legislative session, there were two bills proposed, and there was a great deal of discussion about what should the role of the state be in setting provider policy or provider reimbursement policies. We were asked and are in the process of meeting with the insurance carriers across the state, first of all, to understand what the basis for their policies are, and then what those policies are. To date, we've had meetings with three major carriers. One more is planned for next week. And I'm going to quickly summarize. I think the best way to summarize their policies or stated policies are that they are variably variable. It is difficult to understand the basis for the policies. Only one of the major carriers that we've met with to date states that their policy is to reimburse providers providing the same service at the same rate. Other providers or other carriers, one states that their policy is that they follow Medicare rates and Medicare guidelines, which would be helpful to us because I do understand those. However, when you talk to providers across the state who are reimbursed by that carrier, the stated policy doesn't always play out on the ground. Another carrier did talk to us about the fact that if
provider reimbursement rates in primary care were made the same, that would significantly increase healthcare costs. This is the carrier that made a significant reduction for non-physician providers in the primary care arena, and so the basis for their discussion really was, well, if we brought those rates up, healthcare costs would increase. At the same time, this same carrier is participating in efforts to strengthen primary care and care coordination. So that is as quick a summary as I can give to you about meetings with carriers. I would just like to give you one anecdote that came to my attention last week and have been doing some investigation yesterday. There is a clinical nurse specialist in the state, doctorally prepared, who is one of the known experts in the area of pediatric pain management. She consults with physicians, nurses, and others. She has been reimbursed directly by one of the major carriers for a number of years. And sometime during the last 2 weeks, that major carrier noticed the employing institution that she would no longer qualify to be on their panel. Mm-hmm. And when the institution said, brought to their attention that she'd been a reimbursed provider for a number of years and they'd like to know what the basis for it was, they were met with essentially what the institution described to me as a brick wall, not able to articulate what the reason would be to withdraw reimbursement for someone who's providing a fairly specialized and important service. And as we all know, pain management is one of the areas of health improvement that many entities are trying to achieve. So again, I would characterize our experience with discussions with the carriers as variably variable. Obviously, we've all been talking about the healthcare system of the future. I think everyone in this room knows full well that our primary care system is, the capacity of our primary care system is extremely stressed. Likewise with our mental health system. And so it is very difficult for us to watch these policies roll out and have the effect on providers, but more specifically on the patients that we serve. We do understand that there are some clinics that have reduced hours. There is at least one mental health clinic that has closed as a result of these reimbursement policies. And we fail to understand at a time when we're trying to shift to primary care and prevention as a basis for our healthcare system, how we rationalize reimbursement policies with those goals is very difficult. At that point, I'll stop and turn it over to my colleagues.
Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson, Co-Chairs Thompson and Greenlick, rest of the committee. Thank you for having us. I'm, for the record, Shelda Holmes, and I'm a family nurse practitioner, owner of Hands On Medicine, a small family practice in the very inner city, northeast Portland. I just wanted to remind you what nurse practitioners are, firstly, just to aid in our dialogue. Nurse practitioners have independent scope of practice in Oregon. We are not required to have physician MD or DO oversight. We are credentialed and paneled with insurances and hospitals independently. We work under our own licenses and DEA numbers. We pay malpractice, license fees, etc. Many of us own our own practices. Some of us employ physicians and other nurse practitioners. Most nurse practitioners work in primary care practices, either pediatric practices or family practices. We provide well child and other screening and preventative care. We provide preventative care like well exams, adult exams, urgent care, laceration repair, wound care. We manage patients with complex medical conditions, diabetes, hypertension, hyperlipidemia, etc. We order labs. We take call, some of us 24/7. We consult with specialists. We are specialists ourselves. Not one health insurance company has refused to credential me as a primary care provider. If I was to have that credential removed, I certainly would be asking why. Every insurance company I have approached, which are dozens, deem me suitable to provide primary care to their clients. Yet several of these insurance providers systematically pay nurse practitioners less than physicians for the exact same services. That would be based on ICD-9 codes, CPT office visit codes, and procedure codes, meaning the same complexity and time management for the same illnesses or conditions. A few examples, and these are varied. Aetna cut hands-on medicines reimbursement rates by 15% via newsletter, not contract addendum. As we began contract negotiations in my clinic in 2010, Aetna informed us that, quote, also in case you are not aware, as of June 1st, 2010, Aetna began reimbursing mid-level practitioners 85% of the contracted rate, referencing a newsletter that I certainly never received. My second example is United Healthcare will not allow nurse practitioners like myself to participate in its quality bonus program, which provides incentive reimbursements for providers that meet quality benchmarks. At a time when pretty much our dialogues are very centered around quality benchmarks. So even though there is a growing body of evidence that nurse practitioners have high quality health outcomes, United refuses to let me participate in this bonus program because I'm a nurse practitioner. Pacific Source pays nurse practitioners 15% less than physicians through the Portland IPA, of which I am a member. And that was not always the case, but that is a recent change. These are just three examples that I have encountered of discrimination. There are more. In my dialogue with my colleagues across the state, I know there are more. Every insurance company has an ironclad prohibition, and this is a really important concept to understand, an ironclad prohibition against sharing contracted RVU, that's how we talk about getting paid, RVU rates with other contracted providers. So I can't talk with somebody else about what they're getting paid by a so-and-so insurance company to know how much discrimination there may be. So there's no way for us to know this. To know exactly how systematic this discrimination against nurse practitioners is. NPs are filling the primary care deficit, or trying, and have been for a long time. Excuse me, it's my experience that nurse practitioners provide a disproportionate amount of care to Oregon's children receiving Medicaid, and many of our rural communities rely on nurse practitioners. Nurse practitioners provide comparable care to that of physicians. Study after study, including systematic reviews, prospective observational studies, and randomized control studies, find no difference in health outcomes and a higher level of patient satisfaction from nurse practitioners. In the Institute of Medicine's recently published report, The Future of Nursing, Leading Care, Advancing Health, recommends using nurse practitioners to the fullest extent of our education and training, which is a doctorate in Oregon now, and removing barriers to nurse practitioner practice, and of course I've outlined several barriers, money being one, so as to build the workforce needed to meet the healthcare needs of this nation. This is a 700-page report, though there is a summary that's available. In summary, we simply cannot expect nurse practitioners to continue to provide primary care to Oregonians while allowing their value to be diminished in the marketplace. After all, my bills are not 85% of my physician counterparts. My staff do not get paid 85% of the salary of physician staff. My utility bills and all of my overhead is the same. Nurse practitioners really need to be respected in the marketplace and should receive equal pay for equal work.
Questions? We're running out of time. Can you just sum?
Chairman Anderson, my message is very simple. I work with a nurse practitioner in my clinics.
And introduce yourself.
Yeah, and they do provide the same care, primary care that physicians provide, and that it's bad to not reimburse them.
State your name for the record.
My name is John Ross. I'm an internist. I'm a native Oregonian. I was trained in New York City. I've been practicing in Central Oregon in a designated rural health area for the past 11 years. I have two clinics, Madras and Redmond. I work with nurse practitioners. I have a partner who's a nurse practitioner. They provide the same care. It is very bad in primary care to remove the parity of reimbursement, and that's, I just wish to affirm that from my perspective in Central Oregon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Bates.
Yeah, thank you. First of all, I'll declare a conflict of interest. I have two nurse practitioners that that work on our team in my office, and so I have a huge conflict here, so I'll just lay that out right from the get-go. I didn't hear one issue that I really think is important. I want to bring it to the forefront and ask for a response from you here on the panel, any one of you. In our area and across the state, one of our big issues is keeping nurse practitioners in primary care. We've lost at least 3 nurse practitioners in the last 18 months going into specialty care. And they're doing the same thing at the specialist office they did for us. But the specialists, because of their high income from insurers, can afford to hire away primary care nurse practitioners. And now they're doing intake for orthopedics, they're doing intake for neurologists or neurosurgeons, doing intake for gastroenterologists, and they've been removed from primary care. And one of the reasons is this disconnect on paying them. So I'm supportive of nurse practitioners receiving equal pay for equal care and equal work. But I would tell the caveat I have is I have issues when you move outside of primary care. I think the incentive needs to be you get full pay for what you do in primary care. If you want to go work for a specialist and make a lot more money, do a lot less work, have your nights off, and not work hard, that's fine. But I'm not interested in supporting that. This is really a hot topic for me. It sounds funny, but it's the truth. And let's just talk about the truth here. We've seen that move over and over again. I don't blame them for doing it. It's a smart decision. Better lifestyle and, you know, increase your income by 40%. But the tough work is in primary care. And here we are cutting primary care reimbursement for these men and women who are nurse practitioners. It's an absolutely wrong step to take. So I'd be very supportive across the board, but only in primary care.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess mine is perhaps more comment to our chairs and some discussion that I think I'm recalling correctly that we had. It's been an interesting debate as we've been talking about this race to the bottom, if I may call it that. And I guess my concern is, as I recall in House Bill 3028, there was quite a discussion and there was an admonition, if I think that would be a good word, to leave the room and work cooperatively. It looks to me like I have one group working very affirmatively and other people seem not to be engaged, and I am having trouble understanding that, because I thought the admonition was for everybody to be working on this issue. And I don't know whether I direct that to the chairs or to the parties who are here. I understand this was going to be a cooperative venture, and I just think we ought to put that on the table, and I think it's part of a large picture of really serious problems of reimbursement and discrimination among carriers. And discrimination among participants and providers. I thought there was going to be some cooperative work, and I'm not seeing that.
Yogi Berra said that if the fans don't want to come to the game, you can't stop
them. That's true. That's true.
My recollection is they were going to, we didn't have a formal work group. They were going to
do it informally.
Group,
well, that was my understanding too, and I guess I'm wondering where is what happened.
And we need to hurry up.
Yes, members of the committee, if I just might comment, and this is not an intent to demonize the carriers, but I do think one barrier that we're all facing is a word that I'm getting a little bit tired of, and that's called transparency. It's very difficult to begin to work with partners if the basis for decisions is not known or can't be figured out or is misrepresented. So I would say that our desire would be that this problem would remedy itself with reasonable people trying to come to a decision about what's best in the interest of consumers. However, it is very, very difficult to get there if you don't know what the basis is for decisions. And we continue to encounter the situation as I described to you with a policy being changed, and the only answer is
no answer or because we can. That's very frustrating, and again, this isn't an attempt to demonize anybody, but simply to say you have to have a free market economy where you know what entry and exit of the market is based on before you can really solve this problem outside of a legislative session, in my opinion.
Representative Thompson.
Yeah, I don't need this information right now, but I'm aware of a number of practices around the state, particularly in rural areas, that are solely nurse practitioner, and they're the sole providers in communities. Do you have data on how many of those practices exist? And I wouldn't mind seeing data on how many nurse practitioners are urban as well, but how many standalones are we talking about in the provision of primary care?
Yes,
Representative Thompson. Standalones aren't the whole issue, but yeah, I think it's a big one when we talk about
and
care.
We certainly will be able to provide you with some descriptive data about the way that population looks.
Okay,
be happy to
you.
Do that.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't think we're addressing this issue in 2012. It'll be a 2013, though, unless things can be resolved. Thank you. All right. Now we have three more groups. We'll have to cut it down. Randy Everett and Sammy Patnoid, an update on direct entry midwives.
And I'll talk to Teresa so we can't pull it back and press the establishment.
Give it to the.
Oh, yeah, don't walk.
Yeah.
Just
help
that one.
I'll see if we can
do that. Or we may be taking it to committee bill 23.
Oh, is that right?
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Tressler, could you join us for this? Or your representative, whoever.
Just like
your
job.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randy Everett. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. Thank you for inviting us to come in and present a factual account of what's happened over the last 6, 7, 8 months in Oregon Health Licensing, and specifically in related to direct entry midwives. The agency and the Board of Direct Entry Midwifery continue to work collaboratively to address issues of interest to the committees and Oregon consumers. Following the administrative rule action in 2010, the board continued to work towards greater accountability and regulation. In September 2011, the board filed permanent administrative rules related to risk assessment practice standards, and there's three subsections of those. One requires that licensed direct entry midwives transport to a hospital and transfer care if the client has an evident or suspected footling or kneeling vaginal breech baby. Two, prohibits licensed direct midwives from repairing third and fourth degree lacerations and requires LDN transfer care. The third, in relation to consultation for a non-absolute risk, adds LDM to the definition of Oregon licensed healthcare provider. The Oregon Health licensed healthcare provider must have a direct experience handling complications of the risk present, as well as the ability to confirm the non-absolute risk. The last piece of this is the mother and baby care practice standards, meaning if the mother denies fetal surveillance testing or ultrasound procedure, or if the LDM is denied access to field surveillance testing, the licensed direct midwife must record the information in the client's record and must perform essentially field surveillance testing according to specific board-approved protocols. Okay, with that said, that's kind of the most recent rule action that the board has gone through. What we are doing on the disciplinary end and the investigative end is starting December 1st, the agency is going to be posting specific kinds of action for more transparency regarding the final results of contested case hearings, as well as those public documents related to the complaints that we've been able to, that have been sent to us. Currently, the agency has 29 open cases representing 19 midwives within our licensing group. And
how many are in the state of Oregon?
Pardon me, ma'am?
And how many are in the state of
Oregon? They're all within the state of Oregon.
No, how many nurse midwives?
I'm sorry, ma'am. That would be 75 current licensed midwives. So 19 of them are currently have complaints filed against them, and we're working through that investigative process with our subject matter expert and special investigative group that handles these kinds of cases. One of the concerns of the agency is barriers to licensure. Currently, the license fees for direct entry midwives is high. It's $1,800 a year. We are concerned about that. This is a result, obviously, of litigation that's come to the board, as well as increased investigative activity and the costs associated around those. This fee will probably continue on until we have an assessment starting in May, June, and July, but we anticipate that those fees will start to go downwards considerably. We anticipate at least half of what they are now coming next July, first part of August. But the other part that we are concerned and are planning on taking action on the 1st of January is that new midwives coming into the profession will pay zero for initial licensing fees, but must come up with $145 for the application fee, essentially. So their first year within as a licensed direct entry midwife will be free of charge to them. Then they pick up that renewal fee as they renew on their second year out. So the agency believes that we can do that. The board is supportive of that particular concept in order to make licensing less a barrier for those who choose to become licensed direct entry midwives. Also, the agency and the Board of Oregon Health Authority, Center for Health Statistics, are working collaboratively to ensure the mandates of Health Bill 2380 are being carried out. And that's really the collection of data, birth data from all midwives licensed or unlicensed within the state of Oregon. And as you know, OHLA only regulates licensed direct entry midwives. And that's all I have. I'm anxious to entertain any of your questions.
Do either of you want to make a comment?
No. I would love to make a comment. Chair Monis Anderson and co-chairs Greenlick and Thompson, thank you for having me. My name is Silka Akerson. I'm the president of the Oregon Midwifery Council. And I'm really excited to hear what Randy was saying about removing barriers to initial licensure. What we're working on right now is trying to make sure as many direct entry midwives as possible become licensed. And we have been going up and up in numbers in the past few years, and I'm hopeful that will continue. I wanted to clarify one thing, that one of the reasons why we have such a high number of midwives who have complaints under investigation right now is because of a misinterpretation and misuse of the mandatory reporting law. There was some communication given to obstetricians about that bill saying that it mandated that they report on transfers of care from the home birth to the hospital. So I'm sure that there are valid complaints in that pool, but there are also a lot of complaints in that pool that are about transfers of care that were appropriate. You know, a mom was laboring too long at home and she needed to go to the hospital for augmentation or an epidural, and the mom and the baby are in great condition, and there was a complaint filed about that. The board is such a small board that having those kinds of an increase in those kinds of unnecessary complaints is a large burden. We have mainly been working as a professional organization on improving our peer review after the passage of HB 2380 earlier this year, which afforded us protected peer review, which we're extremely grateful for, and we're working on just improving safety and continuing education overall. Melissa Cheney, who's the chair of the Board of Director and Midwifery, and I are working on a project of going to grand rounds at different hospitals to talk about transport, to answer questions, and to make sure that we're working in a smoother manner with our obstetrician and nurse midwife and nurse partners in the hospital setting. And we're really grateful to be having some excellent partnerships both with legislators and other healthcare providers who are passionate about the health and well-being of mothers and babies, and feeling really hopeful moving forward that we're working on a better and better system.
Representative Parrish.
Thank you. Randy, the question's for you, because you mentioned that you're looking at tracking and data and outcomes. When we had this as a hearing that came up in the last session, I'd asked a question about that same tracking for hospital births, and nobody seemed to have good data. Do we have a better way to capture that so that we've got a comparison of apples to apples? Because I still feel like even if you provide us data on what's happening in midwife births and home births, that if we don't have something to compare it to with, you know, hospital statistics or babies that get delivered in a, you know, a clinic or wherever, under more of a traditional kind of format, we're still operating without all the data that we need to operate with.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. Representative Parrish, you're right. The agency is working with the Center for Health Statistics to hopefully claim that kind of information. We have meetings set up this month and early in December to talk about those folks and how we gather that kind, or how they even gather that kind of information to do that. The agency is also collecting its own information regarding its license directing for midwives. It really isn't helpful, you know, in the big term of what comes out of the hospitals, but we're hoping that it takes place through that mechanism. Of course, the agency doesn't have the authority to collect any of that from the hospitals, so we're at the mercy, obviously, of the Center for Health Statistics and helping to get that. So we'll be talking about that, I believe it's next week and the week after.
Thank you. Senator Bates.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. First, I'm glad the information started to be gathered. Representative Parrish is absolutely right. We need that information. We need to be able to compare apples to apples. Right on. Question I have is information. I'm not quite sure. When I remember going through this last time, looking at the types of deliveries that were within your scope of practice at home, I was pretty shocked by that. Still, I'm shocked by it, and that's a discussion that will come about when we see these numbers. That said, are you paid by the Oregon Health Plan at the same level or same payment schedule that physicians are paid at?
No. We're paid at a much lower rate, and I could get you the exact numbers if you'd like.
Because the other issue involved in this is one of the big factors for physicians delivering infants is a huge cost of medical malpractice insurance in that specialty. It's just an incredibly high number. And my memory of this is that direct entry midwives do not have medical malpractice coverage for the deliveries. That was a concern for me. I mean, there are bad outcomes. There are issues sometimes that come up. You wonder what really happened. And there's not much an area here, from my memory of this, for a woman to be able to have some compensation if she's been treated inappropriately or malpractice has been committed in that particular case. And that's an issue for me, admittedly. I'm a physician, and there's a huge conflict here, and I admit to that conflict, but it's something that probably should be part of the discussion over the next few years.
Thank Representative you. Greenlake and Representative Hoyle, and then we need to move on.
Thank you. It looks like things are moving forward, but this has still turned into a very hot issue in our perspectives, and we get it from all different sides. So Representative Thompson and I are forming a work group to try and deal with this. We've asked three of our members to serve on that work group, Representative Hoyle, Representative Kenny Geyer, and Representative Parrish, and we'll coordinate with them and get some other members, some other parties to join that work group. We'll try and get that moving so we can use the interim to try and deal with several of these questions about licensure, non-licensure, about where that licensure is and other kinds of issues. And if any of our other members would like to join in that effort, we'll be happy to have more help.
Yeah, well, we don't have a forum. We'll still not be a forum. So, no, we're going to ask other people outside of to join the work group.
All right.
Very quickly, just a clarification. Randy, thank you so much. Really appreciate the presentation. You said that women or people that are new to direct entry midwives, that the licensure fee would be waived for this first year, for starting January 1st. Is that people that are new direct entry midwives, or people that are newly licensed that have been direct entry midwives?
Senator Moss Anderson, Representative Hoyle, actually it's those folks who qualify for licensure that wish to become licensed direct entry midwives, that fee would be
perfect. That's great.
Late.
And that's what I was hoping to say. And then the other clarification is Senator Montes Anderson asked how many nurse midwives there are in direct entry midwives. And my understanding is that the number of nurse midwives that are direct entry midwives is very small, less than 10, I think 6 in the state. Or four or something.
Yeah, and one clarification is direct entry midwives and nurse midwives are totally different provider types. There are a few nurse midwives who attend home or birth center births, but they attend those under their nurse midwifery licensing and credentials. And it's a handful.
Stop me, please.
Great. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. I'm sure we'll be hearing from you in the future. With that, we'll have Mary Ellen Glenn, Chuck Hayes, and Amy Joyce review of the DUII enforcement and treatment coordination. And if you can limit that to about 10 minutes, and then we have one further group after you.
Chair Montes Anderson, co-chairs, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Mary Ellen Glenn. I'm the Executive Director of the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission. At the behest of Representative Thompson and Barker, a group has been formed to look into the DUII coordination, the whole system as a whole, to identify areas for improvement and make some recommendations. We're just at the very beginning of this process, so we'll report back to you in 2012 with an eye towards looking at what will happen probably 2013 rather than next year. Some of the issues, the work group has many, many stakeholders from cross agencies, also stakeholders from within the community and behavioral health care specialists, and includes DAs, courts, DMV, just about anybody who touches this system at all. And we've met once, and some of the issues that we've already begun to discuss are how are evaluations conducted, what are the standards and criteria employed by each evaluator, are there uniform standards across each court or community corrections, are there uniform standards across counties, so basically what happens to a person when they're they have a DUII, and does it matter where you stand when that happens. And there's a few questions that are pretty specific, like from a policy perspective, who should be responsible for making the decision to return or not return a license to an offender who's completed treatment, funding of indigent offenders, and then getting down to the nitty-gritty of can we coordinate better through data and tracking individuals across treatment and courts. And should we expand DUII beyond alcohol to look at other intoxicants? In 2008, ODOT and the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII and my colleague Chuck Hayes here did a very thorough examination of the system and formulated some very thoughtful recommendations, some of which have been enacted. My colleague Chuck Hayes is here to tell you about the progress that's been made to date and talk to you about our next steps.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Chuck Hayes, the Chair of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. And as you just heard, back in 2008, the Department of Transportation here in Oregon commissioned the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration to do a very thorough assessment of the impaired driving program here in Oregon. And so what you have in front of you with the handout that I provided, it's just a small portion of that entire assessment, but it really talks about in that handout that you have some of the key areas dealing with law enforcement and then the enforcement of DUI, and then also you will see that there's about a page and a half of 13 specific recommendations that were made as a result of that assessment, and I've tried to give you an update as to where we stand on those recommendations that you will see in your handout. But this assessment really did look at the full aspect of impaired driving in Oregon, not only the enforcement, but laws, the adjudication, prosecution, also treatment and prevention and licensing sanctions, and really gave us some unique things to think about. And really, when they did this assessment, it was very much consistent with what they do throughout the United States with other states that also have been assessed. Some of those recommendations you will find towards the end of this handout, but and also giving you the status. Some of those we've done a pretty good job on, and those that you can see that we have completed with either current legislation and some that we are working on, but there are still some areas that we really do need to kind of consider when we look at this entire impaired driving problem in the state of Oregon. And I like to look at it as a public safety issue and really as a true health issue, because back in my years when I started in law enforcement in the 1970s with the Oregon State Police, retiring in 2003, well, I really saw a change in impaired driving. We referred to it in the 70s and early 80s as drunk driving. And so it has totally evolved into something new and different now, currently. And so now it is truly impaired driving, because we are seeing people that are using many other substances other than just alcohol and are operating vehicles, motor vehicles impaired. And so as you can see, number three on here in the bold that we've mentioned is that, well, NHTSA mentioned to us through this assessment, is that we need to be looking at including any type of impairing substances that are causing problems on our roadways. And unfortunately, as we know today, well, we're seeing a just a huge epidemic in prescription drug abuse, and then there are new substances that keep coming along every single day. And in fact, the last page of your handout is just from a news release from Michigan talking about some of these new synthetic cannabinoids, the synthetic stimulants that are out there, and now something that is just brand new is something called a synthetic hallucinogen, and it's called bromo dragonfly. And so what's happening is that we're working hard to try to make sure that these substances are illegal for people to possess and then drive under the influence of, but yet we have people out there that are just changing the compositions of many of these new synthetic drugs so that they can fall under the radar of the law. And so therefore we are missing these people, people that are driving under the influence of these substances cannot be charged, cannot be prosecuted, and therefore they also avoid treatment. They also avoid some of those other things that we need to be helping them with if they're maybe having an addiction to these substances. So we would greatly appreciate your help in that area. We would like to catch up with the rest of the United States, because Oregon is behind in that area. Everyone around us, Washington, Idaho, California, other states, it is illegal to drive under the influence of most of these substances, but yet in Oregon it is not. And you can escape arrest and conviction because of that. And we also feel very important too is that when these people maybe have some sort of an addiction to these other substances, well, then it's an opportunity to identify that addiction, that problem, get them into some sort of treatment program.
Representative Thompson.
Just a comment on where we're going with this in a direction. We had our first meeting of this group a while back. I was extremely impressed that we had about 20-some people there from various agencies and commissions, and they were all in agreement that we need to do something. Mm-hmm. So I think this is not going to be a fight between various agencies for control or we don't want to go there. I think we've got buy-in to do something about this. And I don't need the discussion today, but one of the things that came up with me since that time, is there possibly a way that we can look at a new program of driving under the influence and leave out intoxicants? Because we always get in the battle of what is an intoxicant or what's the newest intoxicant. It seems to me the issue we're going to address eventually is driving impaired. And I don't care if it's distilled water. If you're driving impaired, that's an issue. And maybe we should be looking at that as well.
So. But driving impaired might be a lot of different things. And
but
it's exactly what we ought to be looking at.
Yeah, if it's dementia, which is my problem, you know, that's a problem for the other people on the highway. I'm driving impaired. We maybe need to look at a broader view of it, but just for future.
Is that drug induced?
Probably. No reason to speculate.
Senator Cruz.
Age and sex.
Just a question. Persons convicted of DUI, they go through a screening and then they have to go to treatment, whether because of screening. And I have a family member who was stopped and convicted and had to go to treatment, and I guarantee you this person doesn't have an alcohol problem. It was just a stupid thing. So, I mean, if we're requiring everybody to go through treatment or diversion, That could be part of the problem, that we're overburdening the system, because some people don't need that. They just did something stupid. Am I missing something here?
Well, that's one of the things we're looking at, is the evaluation standards and how a person is evaluated and what that means and what happens then.
Okay.
Amy, do you have any comments?
Amy Joyce, Department of Transportation. Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson. Senator Cruz is correct. It is a current part of law that if you're convicted of DUI, separate from diversion, that treatment is mandated under the law, and that's one of the pieces that I'm up here to talk about real briefly, is the issue of DMV has an administrative rule that requires when a person comes in to reinstate their license after a DUI conviction that they have to show a certification that they've completed DHS-approved treatment. DMV moved to repeal this rule several months ago based on advice from Department of Justice about legal authority or potential lack of legal authority to have that rule. And we were asked by co-chairs Thompson and Greenlick and Judiciary co-chairs Barker and Krieger to hold off on that repeal so that the 2012 session could look at a potential fix to this situation. So ODOT is part of the work group, both in our role as DMV and the Transportation Safety Division, are committed to working with our partners on that issue and others. But for the 2012 legislature, and the piece I'm here to talk about, is that rule problem that exists and potential fixes that could come into play for that situation to ensure that people who are supposed to get treatment are getting it, that is DMV, the appropriate gatekeeper there. And I describe in my written testimony some of the issues that arise. Potential solution is shifting that to the courts where the sentencing happens and then the enforcement would happen, or at least giving DMV clear legal authority to be doing this function, and then maybe having some sort of release valve or exceptions process for some situations. So that's DMV's perspective on one of the reasons we're part of this work group and what arose here.
Representative Greenlink.
Yeah, one of the issues is about specifically what ODOT approves programs. I mean, I heard that I put a case into the record of a person who had received residential care, I think maybe even out of state, was several years sober after that residential care. When he went to get the license reinstated, this might have been Hazeltine in Minneapolis or something, a very well-known program, but it still wouldn't have met the standards. There needs to be some way to, as long as you're in charge, and if we have to give you that, they have an exception process that allows you to look at what the treatment program was outside of the specifically approved programs, I think.
Chairman Sanderson and Representative Green, like, right, the DHS currently has the authority to approve programs. Some of the, you know, more interesting or unfortunate situations we see are folks who receive, they were out of state when they got their DUI, they get their treatment out of state, it's not approved by DHS. Sometimes, frankly, a judge will order a person to do something other than DHS-approved treatment, or perhaps jail time in lieu of treatment. Unfortunately, that with the rule that exists, that's not something that DMV can approve. And so beyond the legal authority comes the question of who's the appropriate gatekeeper and what sort of exceptions might exist, along with Senator Cruz's comment as well.
Senator Bates.
No, this is actually a question for Representative Wheelock. In the group that you were talking about, the work group, was there a discussion of the issue brought up by Senator Cruz and the variation of what these things look like, and maybe that a judge should exercise judgment deciding we're pulling your license, not pulling your license, and maybe the court, maybe the DMV should be in a situation where the court decides when they get their license back, and then the DMV is off the hook for trying to make that determination. And it also covers the area of different types of intoxicants or impairments. It seems to me this is a job for the judge to exercise some judgment. You know, it's for some people, they get a Dewey, and they're never going to drink and drive again. It's such a shock to them. They've just made a horrible mistake, and they're going to never do it again. Others, diversion programs, especially for young people, is very effective. And then you've got the chronic people, and it's gonna, only going to make them up, if it even does wake them up, is jail time. But the judge should make that decision, not the DMV.
You're asking the wrong person, since this represents the Thompson's group, but no. It is very clear in studying the field, and I've been involved in it, that there's a difference between substance abuse and substance dependence. Mm-hmm. And the screening is really looking for people who are substance dependent. For example, about 80% of male college students abuse alcohol, according to the definition, and they graduate and that goes away. Well,
90%, I mean, but that's okay.
90% of it goes away. That's exactly right. 10%
of it. He says 90% of male college.
90% abuse it, but you're right. The majority of them grow up when they graduate. And, yeah.
It just seems like it should be something that should be handled by the courts, not DMV.
I just answered the question that you are the only one who knows the answer to.
I'll ask you in private. Okay. I'm
gonna okay. Thank you so much for bringing us that update. And our final presentation is on dialysis, Health Home.
Okay.
Jonathan Eames, Gene Stevens.
Or not.
Or not. You know, and sort of people doing the assessment or those trained to do the assessment.
No, I didn't rip it up.
No.
Good morning, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jonathan Eames, Representative Thompson, Jonathan Eames, just for your dementia. Thank you so much for allowing us to come and present today. I know we only have 10 minutes and we'll try to make this brief, but the whole point of this presentation today is to give you a on-the-ground example of what coordinated care organizations are aimed to produce, which is a real-life innovation that's done by a private company that where when you include groups in a risk-sharing arrangement and look for ways to lower cost, raise, you know, achieve the triple aim, this is an example of something that, with no cost to the state, can actually save the state money and save CCOs money. And we're here on behalf of Fresenius Dialysis that Gene will explain, that has 28 facilities here in Oregon. And the chronic kidney disease health home, which is what the CKD stands for, is a way to move some of that expensive care, some of the most expensive care in the state, which is dialysis treatment, and lower the cost by moving it into a kind of a health home or a primary health care home setting. So I'll turn it over to Gene, but this is, I think, a good example of what, you know, it's really tough to figure out what CCOs really mean or really do. We can kind of get the governance and financial solvency and structure, but what does that mean to actually to the patient, the actual person who's going to be in that CCO? This is an example of one piece of that can help. So,
thank you very much, Chair Anderson and Co-Chair Greenlick and Thompson. Thank you very much for this opportunity. My name is Jean Stevens. I'm the Regional Vice President for Fresenius Medical Care. I live in Portland, and I cover all of the dialysis clinics we operate in the state of Oregon. And so our focus in service to the state and to over 2,000 patients that need kidney dialysis is to provide those services. But today I'm here to talk to you about a project that we're very excited about and we would like to partner with in Oregon in terms of the Medicaid beneficiaries. And that program is to look at the people who are not yet on dialysis, the people who are beginning to experience kidney failure, and what is happening to them in their care. Because of our involvement in dialysis going back to the early 70s, we really know and understand the kidney dialysis patient, and we know what happens when they come on dialysis. The first 3 months are the most expensive time for them, ranging up to $50,000 plus, because if they haven't had any pre-care, they are very much in need of major interventions and very often multiple hospitalizations. So this program that we would like to bring to Oregon, we have demonstrated it in other states and to the CMS group that has demonstrated that we can, in fact, reduce the the care for these for patients who are experiencing the beginning of kidney failure by providing a home monitoring program. And the program consists of having a telemonitoring device in their homes. We have nurse case managers who connect with the patients. They every day take their blood pressures, check their blood sugars, and answer other kinds of questions to their care. And then we coordinate those answers with other healthcare providers in the community that would be coordinated through the coordinated care organization. And as I said, that this is the kind of program where we can maybe even delay the onset of kidney disease to the point where they don't need dialysis. But if they do need dialysis, then they, we are hoping to see that they are ready for the best kind of care, that their own conditions are taken care of, their heart disease and other diabetes are under control, so that when they do come on dialysis, that the Medicaid program is, in fact, not experiencing this high cost of their care. The other piece of it is that we can educate them, and education is so important for people who have kidney disease, because if they know what kind of modality of dialysis they want to take, and if they, in fact, are willing and interested in doing home dialysis, then Medicare, if they're Medicare beneficiary, will cover from day one, whereas if they go into the kidney dialysis center, Medicare does not cover until after the first 3 months, which puts the burden back on the Medicaid program. In our testimony, I've written for you, I've outlined this, but most of all, we want to say we're here to partner with the state of Oregon. We met with the Medicaid secretary as well as her staff, and we look forward to beginning this program now and then having the opportunity to work with the coordinated care organizations.
So the cost of dialysis, the cost savings, occurs where and specifically? Because they are able to stay at home?
In this particular environment where the patients are, as I was saying, pre-dialysis, they're beginning to experience kidney failure. Just first of all, the payment for that program is under the Accountable Care Act. 90% of the cost for this program will be paid by this federal program that we can implement. So the cost is really to reduce hospitalizations.
Yes.
And to reduce maybe medications. We teach them, for example, how to if they're diabetic, to check their feet so that they don't end up with amputations. It's all of the preventative focus that we'd like to see that we've demonstrated in the demonstration project that we know will help them. And then, as I say, as they come, if they come on dialysis, that also cost is reduced in that regard too.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee.
Thank you. Do you help patients move towards kidney transplants, which is the obvious way to save money in this area?
Yes, that can also be part of this program, that they would have access to information. Sometimes kidney transplants can be preemptive, if you will, that if we can connect the Medicare beneficiaries to the right care providers, that their opportunity to maybe get a preemptive transplant where they don't have to start dialysis could also be part of the education of this program.
Is that an outcome measure of the things you've done?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing that what you're actually doing is trying to control hypertension and better diabetic control and chronic kidney failure before it goes to acute kidney failure. That's probably where the savings are?
That's correct.
And the model you're using, I assume, is you figure the cost of doing that, really close monitoring of blood pressure, probably on a daily basis.
Right.
Keep them under control and delay the time they go on dialysis, which is where the real savings is. If you can delay that 2 or 3 or 4 years, you've saved a tremendous amount of money.
That's correct.
Is that the basic of the program?
That's exactly right.
And so why is the health authority not accepted as a program and model for the state and mandated it?
I can't speak for the health authority. I would just say that I would say from the dialysis services, the focus has always been in providing the dialysis services, but in the last 6 months to a year, the major focus is looking back to, or looking upstream, if you will, to looking at programs to provide care for patients before they really need those dialysis services. So that's why we're here to look at presenting this.
Senator Bates and members of the committee, that's an excellent question. Actually, this is fairly new technology, and in our meetings yesterday with Judy Moore Peterson and her team, they thought the same thing. And not only with the fee-for-service population in DMAP, but also they encouraged us to go to the MCOs right now, not wait for the coordinated care organizations, but go to the MCOs right now, get this working, get this going, because they're going to want to have this as soon as possible, as well as the CCOs.
I suspect this has to do with categorical eligibility for reimbursements.
I think so too, and identifying the patients that are in chronic renal failure, finding those patients.
That's right.
You know, when your creatinine's reached 2, do we start jumping into the program? What do you do with that?
Senator Bays, right. one of the members of the committee, one of the initial parts of this project is to actually comb through the All-Payer, All-Claims database for those that have the flags for hypertension, diabetes, and those type of things.
All right. Well, thank you, committee.
Thank you.
We may see you in December. With that, no further comments. Sandy, is there anything you need to know?
Jimmy's.
Yeah, Jim.
Just for the House committee, any ideas for committee bills? They're due like very, very soon. So get those to Mitch Rye as soon as you can.
And me.
Actually, get into Sandy is an important piece. But we have to resolve what we're going to do about committee bills here.
And that's the same for the Senate. We have 6 proposed committee bills. Senator Cruz and I are going to figure out which 5 we're going to do. All right. No further comments. We're adjourned.
Are committee bills held to the same December 5th?
Yes.